You are listening to KBOO Portland, heard at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, the Dalles and the Gorge, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and on the web at kboo.fm. My name's Diane. This has been Early Morning Gumbo. Thanks for listening. Tune in each weekday morning from 5:30 until 7 for folk music, and stay tuned now for the KBOO Morning News.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, December 6, 2005. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up this morning, Portland Public Schools want to make Jefferson High School and Harriet Tubman Middle School same-sex schools. Tom DeLay is being charged with money laundering, but not conspiracy. A C-130 transport plane crashed into an apartment building in Tehran today, killing all 94 people on board, yet the building did not collapse. Portland area weather today, areas of fog this morning in low-lying areas, windy in the western gorge later this afternoon, temperatures in the mid-40s to mid-50s, tonight mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, temperatures in the low to mid-30s.
The Portland School District may be on its way to establishing the only single-sex public schools in the state of Oregon. A plan to create two single-sex schools in Portland is underway. Superintendent Vicki Phillips and a team of teachers, parents, and students are proposing that Jefferson and Harriet Tubman divide students into one or the other school by sex. One would become a grade 7 to 12 girls' school with a focus on health occupations. The committee had consensus on splitting Jefferson into two vertical schools. One would be a 7 through 12 boys' school focusing on leadership or an international baccalaureate program. The other school at Jefferson would be an arts and technology academy that would dovetail with a K through 8 program already planned for next year. More than 100 public schools have tried single-sex classrooms in recent years.
A citizen group studying Portland's disability and pension system for public safety workers is proposing an overhaul. The overhaul would strip away most responsibilities of the board that now approves injury claims and retirements. The Independent Review Committee has recommended that the City of Portland's Risk Management Division administer all police and firefighter disability claims and process new claims under Oregon's workers' compensation system. Moving public safety employees out of the Portland Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Fund and into the state system could save the city about $3 million a year. It would reduce administrative costs, allow professionals instead of peers to evaluate claims, and get police and firefighters back to work sooner. The committee concluded based on analysis by outside consultants. The fund is unusual in that it may be the only pay-as-you-go pension and disability system in the country. The committee said with this new deal, the short-term costs to fund new hires and pay pensions for current members would be higher than the current cost of paying the pensions of fund members alone. But consultants predict the cost would level off and go down after about 30 years, according to the Oregonian.
Efforts are building to scale back or kill Oregon's quarter-century guarantee of an income tax kicker rebate for corporations. The state AFL-CIO has filed a pair of initiatives asking voters to change the Oregon Constitution to pare back or end the kicker tax rebate for corporations. Separately, Senator Ryan Deckert of Beaverton said he may try to broker a deal to end the corporate rebate in exchange for a pledge to businesses that the legislature would put the money into a rainy day fund or spend it on projects such as higher education upgrades that businesses favor. Even some conservative politicians and business advocates acknowledge that the kicker may have outlived its usefulness. One crucial element during the tide of opinion against the corporate tax rebate: nearly two-thirds of the tax rebate goes to companies based outside the state. Oregon is the only state in the country with a kicker law. The kicker kicks in at any time personal income tax payments or corporate tax payments exceed state economists' projections for the two-year budget cycle by at least 2%. The unanticipated money is rebated or kicked back to taxpayers. framers of the kicker law, wanted to keep the legislature from spending every dollar it got, so they decided that when unexpected money flowed in, the dollars should be returned to taxpayers. This from the Oregonian.
Two statewide campaign finance measures are heading for the 2006 ballot, yet right-wing groups are mobilizing to prevent meaningful change. The stakes are high. Currently, Oregon is one of the only states in the country with no campaign finance restrictions whatsoever. KBOO's Andrew Geller spoke with political consultant Kevin Looper and has this report.
Now, petitions 8 and 37, which are linked, would curb corporate and union contributions to political campaigns, among other things. But we've heard that right-wing groups are circulating them, and that the measure's progressive support is fracturing. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, unfortunately, that is true. And it's actually particularly disturbing to see these things on the same clipboard with some very terrible right-wing measures. I represent some folks who are actually trying to be the bulwark defending putting out a real progressive response to the right wing so we can once again sort of get back at defining the debate here. And it's unfortunate that we have to spend time dealing with folks that are working with.
Excuse me, that was the incorrect story. We've got the Andrew Geller story with political consultant Kevin Looper.
Protesters from throughout Oregon gathered in front of the Mobile Consulate in Udvan. While anti-immigrant groups were standing across the street, shouting slogans against undocumented workers.
Now, petitions 8 and 37, which are linked, would curb corporate and union contributions to political campaigns, among other things. But we've heard that right-wing groups are circulating them, and that the measure's progressive support is fracturing. Is that true? And if so, why?
Well, unfortunately, that is true. And it's actually particularly disturbing to see these things on the same clipboard with some very terrible right-wing measures. I represent some folks who are actually trying to be the bulwark defending putting out a real progressive response to the right wing so we can once again sort of get back at defining the debate here. And it's unfortunate that we have to spend time dealing with folks that are working with the wrong folks. But the fact of the matter is on campaign finance right now, we got some strong adherents who believe that the problem of money in politics needs to be addressed here in Oregon, and they're absolutely right. We really do need to have some campaign finance reform as soon as possible in Oregon. And the good news is I think we're going to get that. And in part, it may come out of this bad situation where we've got a measure out there on the street right now which is goes too far, takes out a lot of progressive groups unintentionally in the process. But the chief petitioner for that measure, Peter Buckley, a representative down in Ashland, a great guy, has realized that it does go too far. He's pulling back his support for that, and we're going to help to craft some other campaign finance measures that can get filed in the next few weeks, and hopefully we'll receive everybody's support.
Okay, and so now on the other side, the taxpayers' Bill of Rights would curb public spending on social programs, and that's sponsored by a group called Freedom Works. What can you tell us about them and what they're trying to do?
Yeah, these are the bad guys. This is corporate AstroTurf masquerading as grassroots politics on the right. They're run out of Washington, D.C. This is Dick Armey's crowd. This is a bunch of real bad oil, tobacco, big corporate interest folks all waiting to be the next Halliburton that want to be dictating the state-by-state politics in the country. And their newest provision is this proposal called TABOR, Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which is really a taxpayer bill of goods that would take about 25% of funding away from education, public services, human services. It would literally decimate most of the priorities that we as Oregonians are fighting to have more focus put onto.
And lastly, what impact do you think the fray over these measures could have on Portland's experimental new publicly financed election system?
Well, that's an interesting question. I, of course, had done the consulting for the statewide attempt to institute public financing, so I'm glad to see it going forward here on the city level. And this is really not the time to have progressives divided. That's the most unfortunate thing about the folks who are still remaining behind the other initiative 37. We've worked really hard to try to get them to compromise and realize that progressives need to be fighting together, not fractured right now, and the citywide measure needs defense. It doesn't need us all bickering about what's the perfect as opposed to the good.
That was Andrew Geller.
The Mexican Mobile consultant takes off from Portland and tours 17 times throughout Oregon each year to issue ID cards to Mexican nationals who live and work in the state. The last mobile consulate service of the year stopped at the Woodburn offices of the Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United in the midst of both pro- and anti-immigrant demonstrations, FSRN's Mia Kim reports.
Protesters from throughout Oregon gathered in front of the mobile consulate in Woodburn. While anti-immigrant groups were standing across the street, shouting slogans against undocumented workers, pro-immigrant groups marched around the PACUN's office, protecting Mexican immigrants from harassment by anti-immigrant groups. Ramon Ramirez is the president of PACUN.
We were met with opposition by a group of racist bigots who came in and started shouting obscenities to us, claiming that we were anything from communists to illegal aliens, terrorists, and so forth.
Inside the office, about 250 immigrants received their Mexican ID cards issued by the Mexican government. U.S. government officials also informed immigrants about taxes, employment, and driving in the U.S. A man who introduced himself as Augustine came to renew his Mexican consular card. He has lived in the U.S. for 15 years and currently works at a nursery.
The card's important, that way whenever we go on vacation to Mexico, at the border they ask for proof of our Mexican citizenship, and if we show our matricula card, then we have proof that we're Mexican citizens.
Oregon is among a handful of states that do not require a Social Security card to get a driver's license. With the Mexican ID cards, immigrants will be able to open a bank account and obtain a tax ID number to file taxes, but will not change their legal status. According to the opposition, they support legal immigrants, but not undocumented workers, who they believe shouldn't get ID cards. They also criticize U.S. government agencies that were present. Maxine Foxton supports ID card for all immigrants.
I mean, we're talking about families and people that are working, that contribute to our community, who are just asking for basic human rights and unemployment. You know, nobody on the other side is even looking at what are the social issues. Why do people come here? And that when people come here, they contribute by harvesting our food and harvesting our crops and enabling our country to live. And I guess I'm just shocked by the hatred.
Ian Wallace says it is important for privileged American citizens to show solidarity with immigrants.
This particular issue really needs to be confronted, and you can't just allow it to kind of fester and ignore this sort of nationalism and xenophobia, because history kind of shows us what it can grow into. And unfortunately, because of the economic circumstance in this country, white working class people sort of are having their economic privilege kind of stripped away by globalization, and it's a very dangerous period of time because they might be looking for scapegoats and not really wanting to acknowledge that it's their own leadership, the elites, that are making these decisions about their lives.
Adolf Pajamas is a recent immigrant who works at an egg farm.
I'm getting my ID card because I need it to get my Oregon driver's license. And it's just one more piece of ID just in case I need it here in the state.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Mia Kim from KBOO.
A tenacious Hurricane Epsilon is lingering in the open Atlantic, posing no threat to land. The 26th named storm of a record-breaking hurricane season had top sustained winds of about 75 miles per hour, down from 80 miles per hour. Hurricane specialist Lixian Avila said that despite being in cooler water, Epsilon refuses to weaken. Avila said it means we will still have a lot to learn about hurricanes. The storm was expected to turn southwest to areas with higher disruptive wind shear over the next day or two.
Hurricane force winds swept across Colorado yesterday, tipping over tractor trailers ahead of a cold front expected to bring bone-chilling temperatures. A wind gust reached 98 miles an hour, while an 88-mile-per-hour gust was reported outside Boulder. Temperatures plummeted across the northern Rockies. At least 10 tractor trailers were blown over between Fort Collins and Cheyenne, Wyoming.
FEMA realized its response to Hurricane Katrina was broken and braced for rioting over woefully low supplies in Mississippi in the days just after the storm. The correspondence among federal emergency management agency officials follows the release late last week of more than 100,000 documents by Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco. Taken together, the details from both states provide evidence that FEMA was unable to provide fast help at disaster sites, even when the needs were obvious. In a September 1st exchange, FEMA regional response official Robert Fenton warned the headquarters that the expected levels of water and ice being sent were far below that what was needed. The special house committee released 8 pages of emails. While some Democrats are participating, their party leaders have asked lawmakers to boycott the inquiry that they believe should be done by an independent commission. In all, the House committee is reviewing hundreds of thousands of documents from local, state, and federal officials who were involved in the disaster relief effort. The Louisiana documents released late Friday revealed delays in state claims that requests for federal help that weren't received. They reflect partisan battling between the Republican Bush administration and a Blanco Democrat. The House Committee will hold a hearing tomorrow focusing on the response in Mississippi. FEMA spokeswoman Nicole Andrews said the agency is undergoing an internal review for changes as ordered by Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff.
Amnesty International says the United States' refusal to confirm or deny allegations the CIA has run secret prisons in Eastern Europe is a mockery of international law. The United States has lost credibility by refusing to confront allegations about so-called black sites and should conduct a transparent probe to disprove them, Amnesty Secretary General Irene Khan told reporters on a visit to Sri Lanka. The United States has refused for a month to confirm or deny media reports it has secretly held prisons in Eastern Europe and covertly transported detainees through airports across the continent. Yesterday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice defended the way the United States treated terrorism suspects and told European allies to be trusting as they cooperate to prevent new attacks. But in a lengthy statement before leaving on a trip to Europe, Rice did not directly address the allegation of secret jails.
A judge has dismissed a conspiracy charge against Tom DeLay but refused to throw out far more serious allegations of money laundering. The action dashes DeLay's hopes of reclaiming his post as House Majority Leader. Texas Judge Pat Priest issued the ruling after a hearing late last month in which DeLay's attorney argued that the indictment was fatally flawed. The ruling means the case will move toward a trial next year. Other defense objections to the indictments remain to be heard by the judge. DeLay declined to speak with reporters last night as he entered a campaign fundraiser with Vice President Dick Cheney at a Houston hotel. In asking that the case be thrown out, DeLay lawyer Dick Durgan argued that one of the charges, conspiracy to violate the Texas election code, did not even take effect until September 2003, a year after the alleged offenses occurred. Prosecutors, however, said the crime of conspiracy was already on the books and could be applied to the election code, even though such uses were not explicitly in state law at the time. The defense attorney argued that the definition of money laundering in Texas involves the transfer of criminal proceeds. Because the money in this case was not illegal to begin with, they argued money laundering never occurred. But the judge rejected that argument, too, saying the money became suspect when it began to be held with the prohibited intent.
According to RawStory.com, House Democratic leaders this week will try to block any effort by members to adopt an official Democratic caucus position on the Iraq War. In doing so, they are recognizing such a move would highlight internal party differences and invite new political troubles. Leadership sources say Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, and Caucus Chairman Bob Menendez agree that while members are becoming increasingly vocal about the war, a unified position on the subject is still possible to settle on. Still impossible to settle on. Because of that, Pelosi recently asked Menendez to keep this week's caucus focused on a discussion of the war and away from a vote on the subject. Sources indicated that even though leaders will work to keep a vote off the caucus's agenda this week, individual members may still press for balloting on the subject.
Connecticut Homeland Security officials were left in the dark for more than 2 hours Friday after a series of bomb threats forced the evacuation and shutdown of the state's 45 courthouses. Neither police nor Governor Jody Rell's office, which received one of the bomb threats at 10 a.m., had informed the security agency by noon. This left top officials to learn about the first of its kind evacuation from reporters. Public Safety Commissioner Leonard Boyle said the threat fell between the cracks because it was more than a routine scare, but did not rise to the level of a statewide emergency. The bomb threat, which police believe has a hoax design, was a hoax to design, designed to disrupt court business, was one of the first tests of Rell's Homeland Security communications. The Department of Emergency Management and Homeland Security was formed in part to improve communications between agencies.
A closer examination of documents released by the Pentagon, which log all requests filed under the Freedom of Information Act, shows that various individuals connected to the Republican Party filed requests on Democratic Congress members without identifying their employer. Democrats, on the other hand, were more likely to state their affiliation. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee made 8 requests of the Pentagon by name since 2000, as Ross Story reported last week. Those familiar with disguising political Freedom of Information Act filings say that campaigns will sometimes have others sign off on requests. Housemates or friends who are not employed by a political party at the time are sometimes called on to file. Such requesters often go on to become party officials. The Pentagon logs, obtained by blogger Michael Petrelis and given to Ross Story, include requests from names who appear on the 2001 Congressional Staff Directory.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice faces the first test today of whether her defense of U.S. handling of terrorism suspects can quell concern in Europe over alleged abuses, this according to Reuters. On the eve of her first day of her 5-day four-nation trip to the continent, Rice gave the most robust defense of U.S. policies to date. Rice tried to reassure allies demanding explanations after media reports the CIA has run secret prisons in Eastern Europe. She said Washington works with its allies in lawful intelligence operations designed to protect the public, not least in Europe, and eschews torture. But she refused to address the allegations directly. In doing so, she is risking further speculation around an accusation that has been a lightning rod for criticism of possible illegal practices. Germany is an awkward first stop for Rice because new Chancellor Angela Merkel is under intense pressure to get answers on the alleged prisons and covert transfer of detainees. Later today, Rice visits Romania. Human Rights Watch says Romania may have hosted a secret prison. Bucharest has issued repeated denials.
A Vietnamese doctor who has treated dozens of victims of avian flu claims the drug being stockpiled around the world to combat a pandemic is useless against the virus. Dr. Nguyen Thanh Van runs the intensive unit care unit at the Center for Tropical Diseases in Hanoi. Van followed World Health Organization guidelines and gave her patients Tamiflu, but concluded it had no effect. Her verdict casts doubt on the pandemic flu policy put in place by the Irish government. Van said avian flu had a frightening effect on its victims, and the only way to keep patients alive was to support all their vital organs, including the liver and kidneys, with modern technology such as ventilators and dialysis machines. Van would not criticize governments for stockpiling Tamiflu, but she said doctors had to explain its limitations. Roche, the company that makes Tamiflu, has sold stockpiles of the drug to 40 countries and insists there is clear evidence it will protect against a future flu virus. However, it stresses the drug must be given within 48 hours to be effective. The WHO admitted Tamiflu had not been widely successful in humans. This according to the Times of London.
At least 27 Iraqi police officers have been killed and another 32 wounded in a suicide attack on a police academy in East Baghdad, the U.S. military has said. A U.S. Forces statement said that the policemen were killed when two women blew themselves up inside a classroom. The attack was the worst since the suicide bombers killed 74 in two Shia mosques in November. Iraqis queuing at recruitment centers have often been targeted by insurgents. A translator working at the complex has told the BBC that at least one of the bombers was herself a police cadet. The witness said the first bomber went into the classroom before detonating the explosive belt she was wearing. As trainees and instructors tried to escape the scene, there was a second explosion, also inside the academy building. Roads around the complex have been sealed off, and American forces have been helping the Iraqi emergency services to get the injured to a hospital.
An Iranian military plane with 94 people on board has crashed into a building in a heavily built-up suburb of the capital, Tehran. There was a huge explosion and fire in the 10-story block. Police said everyone had died on the plane, and many deaths were feared on the ground. Despite devastating fires, the building did not collapse. State television said the C-130 plane encountered a technical problem shortly after takeoff from Mehrabad Airport. All of Tehran's hospitals have been put on alert to receive casualties. Tehran State Radio said at least 25 people have been killed in the building and 15 were injured. The BBC says the city is currently covered in a blanket of smog because air pollution is especially high, but it is not known if this played a role in the crash.
Pakistan's government is to remove a poem from a school textbook after it emerged that the first letters of each line spelt out President George W. Bush. The anonymous poem, called The Leader, appeared in a recent English language course book for 16-year-olds. Critics say it praises Bush. Its rhyming couplets describe someone solid as steel, strong in his faith. Officials cannot explain how the poem entered the curriculum. Pupils are being told to ignore it. The BBC in Islamabad said it is a bizarre episode which has left education officials short of explanation. At first, they put the poem's appearance in the grade 11 textbook down to a coincidence. An education ministry spokesman argued that the poem was a good description of a true leader, which might explain how it got through the vetting process. But the poem has prompted criticism in local media in Pakistan, where there is opposition to President Pervez Musharraf's support for the U.S.-led war on terror. Some opposition members say the poem shows the government has gone over the top in its support for the U.S.
Ford Motor Company said on Tuesday that its luxury Jaguar and Land Rover brands will no longer advertise in gay publications. Ford is denying that the nation's second-largest automaker made the decision under pressure from conservative Christian groups. Ford spokesman Mike Moran, Ford's Volvo brand, would continue advertising in gay publications. Ford's move came nearly a week after the Tupelo, Mississippi-based American Family Association canceled a boycott of Ford vehicles that began in May. The group criticized Ford for being too gay-friendly. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, December 6, 2005. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News Public Affairs Director. Liam Delta is on the board. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River, on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. and remember to take a look at the KBOO website, all new, all better. But wait, there's more. If you have most of your marbles, come and play. The newsroom always needs fresh blood. To volunteer, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, areas of fog this morning in low-lying areas, windy in the western gorge later this afternoon, temperatures in the mid-40s to mid-50s. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, temperatures in the low to mid-30s. Coming up this morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 on Between the Covers, Julius Sapatier interviews Myla Goldberg, author of Bee Season and Wicked's Remedy. a recent novel set during the 1918 flu epidemic. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with O.B. Hill, Emma Jackson Ford, and Patricia Welch. At 10, Barbara LaMortacella interviews writer Marge Piercy, who will be appearing in Portland this week. Her newest novel is called Sex Wars. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, hear about the first public screening of Bomb Hunters, a film about Cambodia, and part two of a tribute to John Lennon. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News featuring the state epidemiologist on Oregon's derailed tobacco addiction prevention efforts and a live report from the picket line outside McCall Oil. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
As part of healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
Good morning.
Hey.
Hey.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm totally puzzled. The world's going to hell in a handbasket, and we're going to talk about food.
Yeah. Hey, might as well fed on the journey.
Back. Might as well. You know, with us today, shortly, we're going to be talking with Greg Higgins of Higgins Restaurant. What do you call it when something's named after the person? There's a word.
Hippopotamus.
Oh, what is it?
Hippopotamus.
Hippopotamus?
Yeah.
No, that's not right. All right, well, you're listening to KBOO, 90.7 FM, 231-8187 is the number to call. It is talk radio, but we got a guest, and we're going to spend some time with him. And my partner in this crime, Abe Proctor, is going to talk about the economy for a little bit first, aren't you?
Just briefly? I think we'll talk about it, yeah. Hey, Eduardo, you know I'm not hearing myself in my earphones.
I'm going to keep talking. Apparently, we are having a KBOO moment. What we're going to talk about today a lot is food, but we also want to talk about the larger questions of what really is going on in our economic situation today. I'm going to be talking a little bit about slow foods, and Greg is going to be joining us in that effort. We're also going to talk a little bit about the concept of the collapse of a society, the issue that seems to be denied by the powers that be. That is, that you can develop a system of such complexity and such interdependence upon distant sources, for example, for food, that the whole system can't hold together. And it has happened to human beings before. Now, it's never happened in a technologically refined environment like this. But Jared Diamond, a UCLA geographer, has written several books, one of which is called Collapse, which talks about the failure of non-sustainable societies. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about, for example, the collapse of Pueblo Native American culture, which was very, people don't know this, very advanced system of delivering water for agricultural purposes and so on. We'll talk about the Easter Islands and Greenland and a whole bunch of other places where the system, the center did not hold.
Right. I think I'm...
Are you back?
I don't know. Am I back? I am.
We're back. Okay, now you're going to talk about the economy.
Yeah, I found a way to sidestep that new stupid Time Select feature on the New York Times
website. Oh, how do you do that?
Well, they've made you start paying to read all their columnists.
Well, that's the idea,
which
dude.
Is ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous. It's capitalism.
Right. Well, that's ridiculous.
Oh, okay.
So truthout.org reprints a bunch of their better columnists, Krugman and Herbert, all the time, and I've seen a few others there on occasion. So truthout.org, if you don't want to pay the Times for online content. Which
you're so cheap, dude.
They have advertisers to pay for their online content. They should make me pay for their online. And as I mentioned before, all they're doing is losing in the online discourse.
Because I actually agree. You can fight with me, but I'm
right,
just being phony.
The various blogs aren't going to cite any Times columnists anymore. Therefore, their voices are not being heard, in the online discourse.
Yeah.
So they're losing, idiots.
Well, the Times is an idiot. Look at how they let Judith Miller lie to us for all that time.
Right.
All right, anyway.
Anyway, Krugman's column points out, this was in yesterday's Times, that despite the economic numbers that are being trumpeted by the administration, the economy's really not doing well for ordinary Americans.
Well, ordinary Americans, who cares? It's money. It's money that matters.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Isn't that a Randy Newman song? Yeah.
So Bushies don't care because for, everybody that matters, the economy's doing great.
Yeah.
Some of the statistics
were...
The greasy people, the oil people.
Yes.
The contributors.
Yes.
The economy grew 4.2% in 2004, its best performance since 1999. But real median household income fell for the fifth year in a row. So the middle class is losing ground while corporate profits and upper... tax bracket incomes are doing very well. In fact, corporate profits, this is what really floored me, have risen more than 50% since the last quarter of 2001.
How can that be?
That's since September 11th.
How can that,
since we started raping and pillaging in defense of the homeland.
Ah.
See.
Do you see a connection between those
yes,
two?
Yes, I do. Yes, war profiteering.
War profiteering. So what we're really talking about is a wartime economy that works really well for those who are in the defense industry?
That's correct.
So, well, why is Ford having trouble? Don't we make enough tanks with them?
Well, I guess we're going to need to make more. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Tanks for the memory. Sorry.
So truthout.org, if you want to read Mr. Krugman's column, and that's probably a subject for an entire show.
It is. We'll do that as an entire show. Perhaps even. Actually, this experience of the middle class has some relationship to restaurants, too. With us in studio is Greg Higgins, who is what? President, chief, founding father of Chefs Collaborative? Is that true?
Yeah, I got to remember which title we're referring to, but
yeah.
Just local chair. Yeah.
Okay, you run one of the more successful restaurants in the area. I think that's fair to say. I mean, I eat there, and I can't afford it.
Well, we've got you on the hook.
Well, yeah, you've hooked me, and moreover, I actually have I believe that it's perfectly okay for you to charge whatever the hell you want to, because the people that go there, I mean, it's not, it's not Burgerville. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
I mean, I mentioned Burgerville because they're good people.
Yeah, an exponential factor, perhaps.
Yeah, but, and besides which, you got a wait staff that's, I think, very amusing.
In particular, Mr. Zalman, might you be referring to?
Yes.
And amusing? Do they sing? What do they do?
They don't sing, but they do tell you stuff, and they stand there looking very proud of the whole process.
It's
Andy is
familial.
A great, yeah. great
huh,
person.
Right. Andy's a lot of them. In fact, most of the staff's been there since the opening day, really.
Yeah, I guess they earn a living wage or better sometimes.
Part of the business plan, exactly.
But how long? How long you been in business now?
12 years.
Oh. Okay, Greg, why don't you talk a little bit? Without our being silly, why don't you talk a little bit about how Higgins came about, how you ended up in Portland, and what your perspective is on the food thing in general. Do you mind just kind of doing that?
That's a nice, concise question.
Yeah, I'm just kind of, you know.
The food thing?
Okay, how did I end up in, I got to Portland on a bicycle, as a matter of fact. And
Wait. Let's back up a little bit. You got to Portland on a bicycle?
Yeah, my first time in Portland was in the mid-70s, and I was bicycling across the country and came through Portland and found it a pretty interesting place. Kind of made a note of it and didn't get back here for another 8 years or so, but... I found it very intriguing, and I eventually was working in the Northwest in Seattle cooking and had an opportunity to come down to Portland to open the Heathman when it was being remodeled in 84. So did the Heathman thing for a while, a small luxury hotel where I was given pretty much free rein as a chef, but all the while got closer and closer to local producers and farmers and whatnot and realized where I really wanted to be was in my own venue where I could kind of practice some things that were significant, important to me food-wise.
Which are what?
Local, basically. Our basic premise is our business is founded on making farmers successful. So the closer we can be to the farmers and the more we can reduce the food miles, the fresher the food is and the better it is for the local community. So
now, I notice in the literature, as they say, the food literature, that the average distance that food goes to get to our plates is like 1,500 miles. That's the average.
I'm surprised it's so low, to tell you the truth.
Really?
I would think that number could easily be higher. I've heard that number for sure, but, I mean, for a while, Thanksgiving dinner was the big one. Everyone liked to log the miles that turkey travels and all the other components of your Thanksgiving dinner.
Of course, the turkey doesn't know what's happening.
They're not giving
They're pretty
credit.
Much frozen.
They're
by
smarter
then.
Than you think they are, but, when they're frozen, forget it.
I had turkeys once, and when I was on a farm as a kid, and I actually had a little turkey, a small turkey that drowned in a saucer of water. I don't think they're. I think the wild turkeys are smart, but I think the big-breasted birds are really.
Well, there's been some dumbing down for sure.
Yeah, it's all about the white meat.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a.
I don't think it's about the big breasts. I think you should leave your fetish out of it. Personally,
I think we're not going there at all. Anyway, The question of the freshness of food and the localness of food is one of the focuses for today's conversation. I was looking at Brian Hallwheel. Is that his name, Brian Hallwheel? World Watch Institute,
mm-hmm.
talking about the just the general food, what he perceives as a coming food crisis. And this ties in with Jared Diamond's work in his book Collapse and Elsewhere. When you reach a certain level of complexity upon which everyone is dependent. When, for example, you have to use gallons upon gallons upon gallons of oil just to get food to you, your basic commodities, you're in a situation of great risk. And when the interconnectedness of nation states and of resources becomes that complex, it's very vulnerable. It's vulnerable to everything from terrorist attack to just the normal things that happen, bad weather, climate change, whatever. And when people don't, most people don't know how to grow food. Most people don't have any sense of connectedness with their food. They really are in a situation where their own specialization leaves them very vulnerable if anything serious should happen, any serious failures should happen. So that's one interest I have. And then there's the question of commodification. That is the fact that the food business is more and more in the hands of a very small number of huge corporations. It's been estimated that it will be within our lifetimes maybe 5 or 6 major providers of food, mm-hmm. and that's pretty close to already the case, particularly with grain. So you get into this kind of situation where it's both concentrated in the hands of very few profit-motivated capitalist industries, and at the same time you get a great complexity of supply and growth. And then the third factor is the incredible increase in the use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides and so on, all of which kind of contribute to the potential for this collapse. And I wanted to talk to you because, A, I like your restaurant, and B, not unique among restaurants that I like, but I like it. And I also, I really appreciate the fact that you and people like you, Peter DeGamo and so on, are really working to try to create, and I almost want to say recreate, but to create a climate of healthy food production. To me, this also ties in with another issue, which is the growing bulkiness of Americans. When I look at the schools and realize that most public schools, for example, are selling poison to the children in order to make ends meet, that is, they're pushing soda pop and extremely greasy, nasty snack foods for the money. This is kind of educationally dysfunctional and really unhealthy. And I don't think parents really understand the dangers involved, or if they do, they feel absolutely unable to act on it. I see, therefore, that this whole thing has a political dimension that's enormous, a potential of which has been largely ignored by people who ought not to be ignoring it. So that's where I'm at.
Well, it's another broad sweeping stroke, I'd yeah. say. But you're absolutely right. I think that I've heard numbers of there's about 150 individuals who represent the boards of directors of the major corporations. There are about five or six of them that actually really control 85% or more of the world's food supply through their ability to consolidate and to pack things into a tidy little basket. And it's to their advantage to, and they're paid to do that. Their job is to return a profit to the company that they work for. So everything from our seed supply to the agrochemical industry to all different advances of genetic engineering in the form of GMO foods and that are all controlled by these individuals. And a curious factor there is that you have, on one hand, you have this small group of people who are really making the decisions about the majority of the world's food. You've got 1% of the population, percent and a half actually, is in production, agricultural production of the food. So somewhere just a little over 98.5% of the population is being fed by 1 to 1.5% of the population in agricultural production. That's never been like that in history. That's a very precarious balance, the thin veneer of agriculture supporting this huge, massive population.
Well, that's a pretty radical change from the vast bulk of history, isn't it?
It is, and you can see plotted over the last 50, 75 years how dramatic that change has been, for good or for worse. So here's this lumbering giant of a consolidated food industry. And the part that scares me the most, that really is the frightening part, is the single product that more dollars are spent marketing than any other product, and we know how market-driven our society is food. They spend more money marketing food than they do automobiles, than deodorant, shaving cream, you name it. And that's to achieve the corporate imperative of what these guys are after as far as getting us to eat what they want us to eat and suggesting it as a lifestyle. So there's this behemoth out there that's doing all these things. The counter grain to all that, or swimming against that current, is what we're involved with when we talk about local sustainable food and turning the clock back, in so to speak, in the sourcing of our food and looking back to a model that existed before. And it's, curiously enough, it's the fastest growing sector of the food dollar, is the natural and organic food sector, and it's been growing exponentially for the last 20 years. And so it's, of course, attracting a lot of attention of the big money guys. But it's interesting to see that despite everything, this little offshoot of the 60s in getting back to the earth and getting back to natural and healthy food is growing into a real live movement. So that's kind of what we're involved with, is trying to help move that thing along in a good direction.
I see a certain danger. That is that eventually organic food production can be taken over. In fact, it's already starting to happen by the major food giants.
Certainly.
And then you still have the same problems of the vast transshipping and the centralization, but suddenly you have an organic food. And I don't think the average consumer is going to be sophisticated enough to make that distinction between sustainable local organic and just organic.
No, but I think the way I take my take on that is simply that any steps in that direction are better steps. If we can clean up agriculture in some degree, then it's up to the individual and their own budget to determine, where they draw the line, what works for them. And it'd be nice to say that we had, truth in labeling and things like that, so you would know when you went to the store whether those greens actually were organic greens flowing in from Mexico or whether they're actually greens from Canby. But we're not at that point really yet, except for some of the real smaller local stores.
Now, that, the budgetary question looms large here because poor people find themselves in a bit of a conundrum, which is the larger crop yields and the economies of scale that have been achieved by corporate chemical farming essentially price foods without any additives out of their reach. So it's a cruel kind of a paradox that you have to pay more for something without any crap in it. And that leaves a lot of people whose diets are the most suspect right now in the least position to improve them.
Well, food access is a real big issue, and it can be as simple as whether or not there's even a grocery store in a neighborhood. I mean, if you see the predomination of fast food restaurants, if you plot those, it's staggering to see how much marketing and how many of those physical locations are concentrated in inner city areas. Of course, there are throughout the suburbs as well, but, I mean, the proliferation of fast food, which is probably the single, I would say, most diabolical, you know, development in our eating habits in this country over the last 50 years is destroying people, and we're still at the point of denying that. And this whole thing where there's no global warming and there's no obesity problem and everything's just okay, but the key there is that there is going to be an economy of scale issue. It is more expensive for the people producing the food to produce this food because they don't qualify, guess what, for any of the subsidies that other agriculture qualifies
for.
Yeah,
I don't want to interrupt you too much, but that really is an important point, that essentially the policies of the federal government support the mega farmer and do nothing for the small farmer.
Absolutely. So what we're doing incrementally is kind of, you know, pushing this thing along, CSAs and restaurants who support this type of food and local farmers markets and that, and despite all the odds stacked against these small producers, they're succeeding. And I'm optimistic they're going to continue to succeed. There'll be more of them. And you can see it in the pricing of foods in season at the farmers markets. You can see when a crop is in peak season, of course, that you're going to get your best value on it. And it's a socioeconomic imperative to tell people to eat it, you know, when it's peak, and don't eat tomatoes in January or, you know, whatever, those type of things. It's an argument for seasonal food. As far as the income issue, you know, most great social change movements in this country have started, unfortunately, in the upper middle class, and they percolated down, whether it's the abolitionist movement or it's the suffrage movement or you know, protesting the war, whatever it is. Most of those things start and work their way down into society because somebody has to have the financial ability to take that plunge and, you know, take that step and lead, and then things progress from there. So optimistically, I see that percolating through in what we're doing. I mean, I started out as an organic restaurant 12 years ago, totally focused on food, and now we're seeing that get down into neighborhood restaurant approaches and even in college cafeterias and things. So there's progress being made. It may not be as fast as we all like to see it happen, but it's coming along.
I want to ask you, you mentioned CSAs. Now, that's what, community-supported agriculture?
Exactly.
What is that? How does that work?
Well, it's basically, you know, running a farm is, you know, boom time is harvest season where you get lots of crops to sell and lots of money comes in. But throughout the rest of the year, you still have lots of expenses. You have your mortgage. You have you're paying your staff. You have investing in more seeds and more capital equipment and whatnot. And you don't have cash flow all year. So CSAs is a way to pay the farmer and help him ahead of time with that. So in the springtime, where you buy a share in an agricultural CSA, maybe you save $500. You pay your money up front. And then you get the goods throughout the season. So the farmer gets the money ahead of time to help finance those expenses he has, and then you get a steady supply of vegetables and fruits throughout the season. So it's like a future in food.
Now, this is a talk program. The number to call is 231-8187, and I think we have some. Do we have some callers? Who's first on the line there? A school teacher. Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, well, I'm a school teacher in Independence, actually an elementary teacher in Independence. And I'm really fascinated on the topic of healthy foods in schools because a lot of the parents, you know, and children, many times, you know, they just get the information from parents. But a lot of parents don't understand the connection between, you know, like in schools, we're labeling a lot of children, you know, ADHD, attention deficit disorder, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't make that connection with the food that they're eating. For example, a prime example would be one of my kids that was, you know, having, you know, just two breads and marshmallow jelly. And marshmallow, what is that? Some type of marshmallowy syrup that they put. That was his lunch. That was the kid's lunch and a Pepsi for lunch. And that kid was was labeled with attention deficit disorder. He didn't have an attention deficit. He had, like, you know, he was overeating sugar, you know, and it just made him and made him extremely hyper.
Yeah,
you know,
eventually it'll give him diabetes if they're not careful.
Right, and a lot of the parents, they're connecting it. You know, and for example, we teach about, you know, nutrition in schools, but we hardly practice it because a lot of the schools don't say anything about their cafeteria food. But I guess it's better to have something, but we don't really get into the debate because sometimes we're very unfamiliar with the topic. And so when we're talking about, it's very important, you know, to talk about the local economy. We need to start that dialogue even within schools, and it needs to be reflected in the curriculum, because often we don't talk about how nutrition and how, you know, growing food healthy organically has an impact even in education. And often, you know, as educators, you know, some educators practice healthy eating habits for themselves, but they don't, you know, they don't go against what's happening in their school. And that is so essential. They need to educate others about the need to feed healthy food to children, you know, and what kids eat matters and impacts their education.
No, I agree with you. In fact, I have a suggestion. You're in Independence in the Valley?
I'm in Henry Hill Elementary in a school.
I'll bet you there would be a farmer in your area who would be interested in donating, I don't know, a quarter acre, half an acre, to creating food plots to work with kids, say, in the third through fifth or sixth grades to actually grow their own food. Not just to grow flowers or to have a kind of a symbolic garden, but a real practical garden. And I'll bet if you did do that, that could bring the school in contact with the dairy farmers for the manure. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you could actually have a practical educational program that could teach about something that the farmers would appreciate, that is agriculture and how it works. You could also be teaching about nutrition. You could be teaching biology. You could be teaching so much at a practical level and introducing theory into the everyday lives of students and teaching them about nutrition.
Yeah, well, you know, let me tell you, you just gave me a good idea, because often we try to imitate, you know, growing food in schools, you know, like a small school. But really, I mean, we're trying to imitate what, you know, what farmers do, and we need large tracts, like you were saying. You know, I mean, we can grow a little garden in a school, but once we start...
Uh-oh. Oh, we lost him. I'm sorry, man. I really appreciate your call. I think that what I'm suggesting here is something that could be happening in a lot of places, and to some degree is already happening in some schools in the Portland metro area, and I suspect elsewhere. But I think that the connection, we, all of us, have lost our connection with the land, and in fact, the land is what sustains us. And I think this is a vitally important issue, and I wish the schools in Portland, for example, were focused more on this issue.
You know, beyond just the land issue, Joe, I think there's also a disconnect just with food. So few people know much about what they put into their bodies. And it starts, of course, on the land, but it also continues, that you can sit down in front of a television and see what... I mean, I laugh. I mute the commercials and I just laugh because I can't believe that they can sell what they sell for the prices and that they can sell it as food, because none of it represents food to me. And unfortunately, I'm a minority in that case. Most Americans think of that as food. And so I think that's a primary issue. And that's an education issue, too. I mean, and talk about a disconnect. We spend less on food than any nation in the world per person, and we spend more on medical care, and there's a very direct relationship there, and it percolates. We see it in our kids. We're concerned about our kids, but it's an epidemic throughout our entire society on that basis. I mean, there's a relatively small number of people who are listening and trying to figure this out.
Well, as a parent, it sometimes feels like you're fighting a juggernaut. I go with my son to the supermarket, and there's Yoda telling him what to eat, and there's a million different characters telling him what to eat, and prizes in a box of cereal, and all the billions and billions of dollars spent every year convincing kids that they need to eat these things.
Sure.
And it can be, I imagine, for many parents, an overwhelming sense of opposition.
Well, in fact, I was thinking about this in terms of a lot of parents, in order to be middle class today, both parents have to work. I mean, this is an increasing
reality. Yeah.
So you even have less time to spend in educating your kids about appropriate diet and so on.
Yeah.
And you're also looking for fast food. You're looking for something quick to feed the kids. You don't have the time. You're tired. Your energy's low. You come home. You got to make something happen really quickly. All this product is geared essentially to that reality.
It's ironic, too, because, you know, would Yoda drink Pepsi? Of course he wouldn't.
Yoda?
No. Yoda's a Jedi Knight. He wouldn't drink Pepsi.
Jedi Knights drink Pepsi. Everyone knows that.
No, they do not.
How else can they splash those lightsabers?
They do not.
I mean, come on, give me a break. Every Jedi Knight is a Pepsi junkie or a Coke junkie. We don't say Coke on the air, do we?
No. No.
Anyway, because that might be confusing. Okay. Greg, sorry. Little riff on the Jedi Knights. Your restaurant is one of what? Now, how many are trying the same thing? That is, how many are in this chef's collaborative?
Here, well, nationally, there's about 1,200 members in the Portland area. I'd have to check the database, but there's 20 or 30 restaurants involved in helping move along the issue. And what it's all about is basically educating the chefs so that they in turn can educate their customers about where their food comes from and what are better food choices. And we spend a lot of time working on direct marketing relationships, building opportunities for farmers to come direct to the chefs, get a little better dollar value for their product, decommodify food essentially to celebrate food for what it is, especially great local sustainable food.
You know, this reminds me that I wanted to mention one success story that I missed out on. Back in about, I don't know, about 90, I was doing commercial talk radio, and I got this call from this guy, Doc Hatfield.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been railing about the food industry, and out of the middle of nowhere on this commercial station, this guy calls me and says, "Hey, you ought to come out to our ranch. We're doing something entirely different." And I was, you know, kind of, "Oh, yeah, well, thanks. That's good to know." And then I didn't take him. Here the guy's inviting me out, seriously, inviting me and my family, whatever, out there to see his operation and to breathe some fresh air and smell the manure and whatever. And I didn't really understand who I was talking to or what I was talking to. But Doc and Connie Hatfield are the leaders of a real movement in this state, the Country Natural Beef Cooperative.
Sure.
And they are producing, from what I understand, beef that has not been messed with. And those of you who are meat eaters, and I know a lot of our cable audiences are vegetarians, but those of you who are red meat eaters should know that what those guys are doing is they essentially have unplugged themselves from the whole meat industry in such a way that, if I understand it correctly, and I guess this is true, you can safely eat their beef.
Yeah, their beef's excellent quality. And it's more than just the fact that it's free of antibiotics, steroids, and all the other subtherapeutic drugs that are routinely used in the cattle industry. The animals are well treated. They're organized in a way that they don't spend a lot of time on feedlots. They're moved through the processing thing in a very humane manner. But even more, in a deeper look, they're working on rebuilding the fabric of the agricultural communities that are involved in the production of that product, meaning that they encourage their members, in fact, it's a requisite of their members, to actually be a family unit working an operation, not absentee ownerism, not a ranch owned by some corporation, but actually a multi-generational family program where the kids are involved and are going to eventually take over the ranch. And we forget about what's happening in this urban disconnect where, you know, everybody's flocking to the cities and the corporate parks around the cities and changing the settlement patterns of our country and eating up land. In the meantime, it's emptying the agricultural communities, the rural communities. They're trying to help to stem that tide.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Joe Uris. My partner's Abe Proctor. Our guest is Greg Higgins. Today's topic, food! More food. I wanted to raise an interesting point. Willie Nelson and others in the entertainment industry have organized this Farm Aid Project. Essentially, they're trying to save the small family farms, which are disappearing in, I forget, several hundred a week rate.
It's staggering.
It really is. And what's happening to that land is it's mainly turned into corporate farms. And farmers cannot make the nut. They're disappearing. But it seems to me that the movement that you're involved in, the work that the Hatfields are doing and others, have the promise of restoring those farms and maybe turning this whole thing around. Or am I being too optimistic?
I don't think you're being too optimistic. I mean, it's a big uphill, you know, battle to change that. But let me give you a simple statistic. And I moved here in '84. There were 3 farmers markets in the Portland area. Today there are 30. So, I mean, just think about that in the span of about 20 years, we could multiply the farmers markets by that. That's evidence of the demand. If there wasn't a demand for the product, there wouldn't be the markets. If there weren't enough farmers, there wouldn't be the markets either. So progress in the movement is going, and it's not maybe at the same level everywhere in the country. We're fortunate to live in one of the best agricultural valleys that exists, but we are seeing that change. We're seeing people going back, and what's curious, though, is a lot of these aren't huge, you know, 500-acre, 300-acre things. A lot of these are smaller, highly productive, bio-intensive kind of organic and sustainable farms. But just the same, I mean, I have 30 or 40 different producers that supply our restaurant, all sprinkled throughout the Central Valley, some of them as far away as the border of Idaho, like Joseph, and a few up in Washington and that. But that's, I mean, it's taken 20 years to connect with that group of people, and a lot of them are just starting into it. These aren't old family farms in all cases.
I wanted to touch on something you mentioned briefly earlier, and that is labeling. Now, are we to understand that when you go to the store and you buy something that's labeled organic, that might not be what might not fall in line with what you might conceive organic to mean?
Well, organic has been very carefully, thoroughly defined, as the federal government would have us know, in about a 600-page document called the National Organic Standards Act, which took some time to draw up and then a couple more years to actually get passed and make everybody happy with. And so specifically, according to the national government standard, organic has a very defined meaning. So when you see it used on a label, you know you're getting something that complies with the terms of that 600-page document. So generally speaking, that's a good thing. There are things that go beyond organic. Small producers that work, and Joe alluded a little earlier about, you know, what really is organic and sustainable versus anything else. So those are sort of arguments that you'd have to get into to sort out what's your real definition of is organic enough? Does that suffice for you?
Well, but there's another issue there. Apparently, right now, there's going to be there's an attempt in Congress to revise the organic standards to allow GMO foods and so on. I mean, this comes up every
There's tremendous
session.
Pressure, yeah.
And that's a real danger. Oddly enough, the hero within the Senate of all of this was Orrin Hatch. Mm-hmm. Of Utah, who's a Mormon and who happens to believe very strongly in organics. Another oddity that people may not know is that the White House under Ronald Reagan served only organic unmessed with meats.
Hmm.
And I didn't know that until very recently. Now, I don't.
There must have been some kind of clerical error.
It was no, actually, it was the fact that the Reagans. To the extent that he was still a capable and thinking person, which we could debate, were very conscious of this. Mm-hmm. And what I fear, and this is we've sort of alluded to it, but it's really an important issue, is we are developing a two-food society.
Exactly.
The wealthier and more conscious of us, the better educated of us, will spend a significant portion of our income, unless we're rich, and then it doesn't matter, but we'll spend a significant portion of our income on healthy food. The rest of us, more and more of us, will be eating whatever crap is available to us out of convenience and pressure and necessity and market forces and so on. And I see that as a vicious degradation of the American lifestyle. And I'm very concerned about this. I'm very, very, very worried. Because you see the increasing obesity among poorer people, you see the whole fabric of health in the society deteriorating at the end, which you alluded to, at the end of food, and then the pressure then falls on the medical establishment toward the other end.
Well, I think there's a couple things that you know, specifically the solution to me, more than the issue just about access to the food, the first primary thing we've touched on that is education.
Mm-hmm.
We don't teach about food in our schools. I mean, when we teach about food in our schools, we teach about them as the Boston Tea Party or the colonization for sugar or, you know, any of these things just as historical footnotes. We don't deal with food as the significant cultural component that it is. And it's a social component, too. I mean, throughout history, there are many examples of better nourished peoples triumphing over other people. The Romans knew it. I mean, all the great, you know, dominating empires knew it, that if they weren't well fed, they couldn't succeed in their goals. I'm not talking about that as an imperative for us. I'm talking about it as an imperative that this disparity that's occurring, the two-food system, is being reinforced by the fact that what people know about food they're learning off the television, and I'm not talking about the Food Channel. I'm talking about mass marketing of unhealthy food. And until we change that, until we make children aware of what better food choices are, and it has to start in both the classroom as well as the cafeteria, it's going to be an uphill battle. It's not going to matter how much food costs if we can't make it desirable for any number of reasons beyond just the cost factor.
It's going to be an uphill battle for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. These things are so pervasive. I take, in my mind, high fructose corn syrup.
It's one of the nastiest
things ever forced upon the populace. It has never appeared on the planet. When did it appear? A few decades ago?
Well, it's curious that, you know, Betty Fussell wrote a fascinating book about corn, basically the biography of corn. And when you read that book and understand, you know, corn is king, as they say. And, of course, that's where the high fructose corn syrup comes from. But all the other applications of corn, and guess what? It's one of our major GMO crops. So this thing is intrinsically tied back into those 150 guys who are making all these big decisions on a worldwide basis for agriculture. I think that you've hit right on the nail right on the head there, in that high fructose corn syrup is going to maybe be the thing that drives this through, because the epidemic of adult acquired diabetes is being driven by that. When you track the sales, right now the fast food industry, of course, is combating it in the courtroom and whatnot. But we're hitting epidemic proportions, and it's only going to get worse. And that expense alone on the national healthcare system could be the bullet that actually pushes this thing into some more creative and big dollar, you know, attempts at solving some of this.
And of course, ironically, it is the federal government that supports the corn industry.
Of course.
And you know, even on public broadcasting, there's these big ads for corporate farms, enormous pressure. The fact of the high fructose corn syrup's close association, I want to be scientific, the close association between the rise of obesity and late stage diabetes, and fructose, high fructose corn syrup, cannot be denied. But if people don't know that, and they don't, it goes just completely unmentioned. When I was a kid, we used to watch movies, 16-millimeter sound movies, as a big treat in school. And a lot of the films were actually films produced by the PR people in the food industry. I mean, even then, we're talking a long time ago. And they were, you know, like the Campbell's Soup people or the Heinz people or whatever, talking about how they invented a carrot without a core. You know, the core was not the yellow core was no good. They wanted an even orange-colored thing, and they had invented an even orange-colored thing. There was no discussion of what the implications were for the health of the carrot. But the question was, can we make a carrot that's all orange through and through? Or the tomato that has to be as red as possible, no question about what the flavor or the nutritional value of that tomato. But we want one that packs well, that is a really solid tomato. The flavor is irrelevant, and as far as I can tell, vitamins are irrelevant too. But we were learning that even then, and that's before the rise of the current corporate farm structure.
Now, one of the problems... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Greg.
No.
So, getting back to high fructose corn syrup for just one moment. Is it a...
I think I'm going to glug some now. That's good.
Yeah. As I understand, it's especially bad because it's not easily metabolized. It's very easily rather stored as fat.
Right.
And the problem is, though, even when you alert people to its dangers, you know, we naturally gravitate towards things that are sweet and things that are fatty, because from a Darwinian perspective, those sorts of foods in pre-civilization days means a better chance of survival.
Sure.
So, you know, the answer is not...
A layer of fat is where it's at.
That's right. The answer is not to turn away from, you know, high fructose soda pop and then go to diet soda, because then you've got a whole other plate full of problems associated with artificial sweeteners. So, I mean, we're talking about essentially asking Americans to not eat as many sweets, and that it's a tall order in and of itself, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, Allen Ginsberg told me at one point, we've gotten this odd conversation about food. He was at the Naropa Institute, which is up there in Colorado, you know, very, very Zen, very, you know, Eastern religion-based place, and he was teaching poetics there. And he was one of the advantages of working there was you always got fresh squeezed juices from any source. And he said it never occurred to him. It was hot. It was dry. He drank a lot of juice. It never occurred to him that, in fact, what he was drinking was enormous amounts of sugar. And he ended up with diabetes, late-stage diabetes.
Mm.
And he also ended up, for other kinds of reasons, I suspect, what finally killed him was cancer of the liver. But the fact of the matter is that he suddenly found himself being a diabetic. And the point I'm making here is that it isn't simply a question of the fructose in the diet. It's a question of the wisdom.
Well, there has to be a balance.
There has to be a balance. And he lost, I think a fairly intelligent guy, lost that balance in the process of the pure pleasure of fresh juices.
Mm-hmm.
There's an irony. Mm-hmm. Now, I know people who go on juice diets and they live on that stuff for a while.
Well, you know,
they turn yellow, but that doesn't matter.
In sort of a peculiar fashion, and I don't think anyone could have predicted this 20 or 30 years ago, that the chefs have been thrown into this sort of role as culinary food dietary gatekeepers of sorts. Suddenly we're celebrities. Suddenly we have our own network. Suddenly we're everywhere. Chefs are making people's food decisions for them. And so our collaborative group, that's one of the things we're about, is mm-hmm. teaching good food values, not just about taste and texture, et cetera, but also about the environmental implications of food choices and the personal health implications of food choices, as well as the aesthetics and the culinary side of it. So that's our goal with our group, is to teach chefs to make better choices. And if you think in terms of how many people that represents, our restaurant, for example, well, we probably feed somewhere around 7,000 or 8,000 people a month. So that's a lot of incidences of suggestive selling or talking to people about their food in a subtle way. So over the course of a year, I, see 100,000 or 200,000 people and sway their thoughts about food a little bit. If we can have that permeate down in a broader sense into neighborhood restaurants and as I mentioned, it's starting to happen in college cafeterias and corporate cafeterias, things like that. The odd thing is that the place where it probably is most needed is in our institutional food, in our schools and things, and that's the last place probably it's going to get to. But that's the kind of progress we need to get, is to change how people think about what they're putting on their plates and into their bodies.
I wonder if we could. I mean, we had a call earlier. We should take some more calls. We had a call earlier from a teacher from Independence talking about this issue with schools. But I wonder if we don't have an absolute imperative as parents, as citizens, to be making a lot of noise around this issue in the schools. I mean, there's so many issues around schooling now. But I really think that you get all this behavioral stuff would be so much better handled if these kids weren't jacked up on sweets and caffeine and fats in their diet, which the schools are then selling. Let's go out to some of our callers. The number to call is 231-8187. Of course, you're listening to KBOO. Abe Proctor, Joe Willis. Our guest is Greg Higgins of Higgins Restaurant. We're talking about food and food-related issues. Let's go out to Story. Hi, Story. How are you?
Guilty.
Guilty of what?
Well, whatever. But so many topics have come up, but
if you send me $100, you'll feel less guilty.
Right. Or just come and make repentance confessions to you.
Well, just lay your hand on the radio and write a check.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, through evolution, we've been programmed to be sweet seekers because the evolutionary history was that the sweetest or the most tasteful food simply meant that it was at its peak nutritional value, and of course that's all been contradicted, but the real reason I've called is that this has actually was undertaken over 100 years ago, if you remember the farmers movement, and started actually in Kansas, where the farmers were trying to keep their small family farms, but it was made economically impossible, and there was a huge campaign toward denigrating rural life in general, and all rural people, whether they were coal miners or farmers or whatever, as being something less, almost being as a Cro-Magnon or Neanderthals.
Well, yeah, the hayseed stereotype.
Right, from which we got all of our maligning cartoons about rural people, like Little Abner, there was a huge campaign by the Eastern publishers who were owned to to compel people, well, one, economically, they made it impossible to survive, the small family farm to survive, but as also sharecropping was very important in terms of utilizing and subjugating certain portions of the population. But the idea was to drive people into the cities where they could be keep wages lower and industrialization. And so, I mean, this is a huge part of our history.
Well, no, actually, I'm glad you raised all that. Upton Sinclair, Frank Norris, others of the so-called muckraker school, we're really exposing all this. And one of the things that's happening right now, ironically, is this whole process that you discuss of 100 years or more ago is being reproduced right now in China.
Well, no, it's happening right here. If you think about it, the whole idea that that we still don't make it economically feasible to survive, or at least attractive for a domestic workforce to work in rural areas. We want a subjugated immigrant population to come in and do an indentureture working at sub wage levels. You know, as a way of filtering up. And I mean, but my point is this has been going on for over 100 years. Is even if you just read the What's the Matter with Kansas, this is a little very brief reference to what happened and how the rural movements toward trying to keep their product prices sufficient so that they could sustain the small family farm. But I mean, this has been economic, cultural. And so I just wanted to point that out. It's in our history, but the history isn't studied and this isn't viewed. So anyway, have a good day.
No, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Do we have another caller? Take another one right now?
Maybe.
Perhaps. Okay, hi.
You're on the air.
Hi.
Gordon. Hey, Gordon, what's up?
Hi, gentlemen. So I've got an alarm going off right now. So I've been listening to the food, and I've got a friend that's on the board of agriculture.
Gordon, I can barely hear you. I don't know what the deal is.
Oh, that bill that you guys are talking about, the organics,
uh-huh.
That was passed last week.
What bill?
The bill to put in preservatives and food colorings into our organics was passed in the back room of the Republican meeting.
You mean we can no longer trust the organic label? Is that what you're saying?
No, you cannot. You cannot. They passed that last week, and that was pushed through by Kraft and Monsanto. So we must read our labels. So I got 3 minutes here. First of all, Japan, they won't even take our food. They're waiting for a generation to find out how our people do on GM food because
yeah.
They closed their door. They're the largest wheat importer in the world. And 3 months ago, they said they will not import wheat anymore if we genetically modify it. So Monsanto went and modified it.
Modified the definition or modified the food to fit the Japanese market? That's
modified the wheat to be Roundup Ready and stuff like that.
Oh, I should explain to people, Roundup Ready, and there may be some confusion here. Roundup Ready means essentially that the food has been genetically altered so that it can take a lot of poisons that would normally kill it. And then we, of course, get the poisons, too.
Right. It comes down. And so I have a friend that does a lot of research on the foods. And you're right. The sugars is really bad because we're addicted to the sugars. They've refined them so much to become addicts. So you're talking about 280 million people have to go through withdrawal to get off the sugar that they've created because it's a monster. But the real problem in our food is the fact that Monsanto, who makes Roundup, is the owner of the world's largest seed manufacturer in the world called Siemens, and they want to GM all the food.
Wait a minute. The largest seed manufacturer is Siemens?
It's S-E-I-M-E-N-S.
I think that's obscene. Sorry, I can't resist.
That's all right. Now, the real problem in this food, we know, is the hydrogenated oils, which comes from the largest corporations in the country, the food corporations, the oil companies, the veggie oil people. We're dealing with hydrogenated oils that shouldn't be eaten in the food. They're carcinogenic. They kill you. We are also dealing with MSG. It's horrible for us. So these are what they're putting in our food. And the corn you guys were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
That's the easiest corn to do. Corn is the easiest to manipulate out of all the food. And they're putting pharma foods in the corn. So you could be sitting at your dinner table eating corn and have blood thinner or anxiety medication in your corn and not even know it through cross-pollination. So you have the ultimate in the dumbing of a society through empty food, and you have the ultimate in job security through manipulating the body to not be able to filter out all these toxins because there's so much of it. Because we can filter it out, but there's so much of it, we can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're becoming sick. And they did a study, and it's really not the sugars that the kids are having a problem with. There was a study out of UCLA, the petroleum they put in our food. It's the food colorings and the preservatives are actually oil that runs in your vehicle. And that has a problem with the neurotransmitters that don't let the body function right with the neurosystem, and they completely crash, and they become these monsters for like 15, 20 minutes. So then they're supposed to actually go to sleep after you feed them, but they become worse because these oils are having problems with the neurotransmitters in the system. So,
hey, thank you for the call, Gordon. I appreciate your
input. Yeah, it's really big. So just eat organic and watch your labels. So,
thanks a lot, Gordon.
Yeah, read your labels is a pretty sound piece of advice.
I don't know about the oil, but he does make an interesting point. That is that years ago, Lyndon Smith, a pediatrician with some note, was very concerned about this attention deficit disorder, KGB, GBD, D, whatever, phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Attention deficit disorder.
What?
What? Oh, I wasn't listening. Oops. Anyway, attention deficit disorder. And he suggested that he believed it was sugars to a great extent that caused this. But he also, actually, as our caller suggested, I don't know about the oil issue, but as our caller suggested, that a lot of the chemicals derived from petroleum, a lot of the dyes, the aniline dyes, et cetera, that are somehow work their way into the food system, may be responsible for the neurological mess-ups that cause these kids this problem. So it's not as far out as that, particularly the coloring, the food coloring.
Well, this ties into something Greg mentioned earlier, and that is we create a lot of problems on the back end in the form of long-term health, serious health problems. We create them at the front end by putting all this unnatural crap in the things we eat. And so, yeah, that relation, I think, is one that has not been investigated enough. And, there's definitely a cause and effect there.
So, to Greg, what we're talking about now, we're talking about a whole bunch of alternatives. We're talking about people being able to invest $500-$600 in community-supported agriculture, in small farms that then yield them enormous amounts of food over a period of time, with a small degree of risk because the crops can fail. But if they're diversified, not all the crops are going to fail.
Sure, you're guaranteed
time.
To get something.
You may not get tomatoes one year, and you may end up with zucchinis instead, or a gazillion eggplant.
But you'll get food.
You'll get food, right. And we're also talking about outfits like what Doc and Connie Hatfield are doing and the many others in this Country Natural Beef movement. And then there's a lot of other outlets, the farmers markets and so on. All these things. But again, my concern is that these are the elite.
Mm-hmm.
This is a culturally elite movement. I mean, there's a lot of people involved, but it's not everyday folk. It's not the ordinary working person who's struggling to make their nut. And I think that that's where the attention has to go, and I think the educational system is crucial to that. But I also think we really need to think a little bit about getting people back to the soil themselves, about producing their own gardens.
If this has its own set of challenges, of course, but one of the simplest, and it's teaching someone to fish thing, and it's the same thing. It's teaching somebody how to grow food, and I think we often make excuses for why we don't have little backyard gardens, little potagers, or whatever.
It's dirty.
I don't have space. I don't have time. I don't have this. I don't have that. But if you travel, and particularly outside of the U.S., it strikes me in many many cities in Europe and Asia, you see plots, small plots of land. So it's about any little plot that can be worked. People are trying to grow something on it. And you see it around the cities. You see it in belts, usually just on the fringes of the cities. Sometimes you see it in between buildings in the center of, you know, densely populated urban areas and that. And you just don't see that much of it in our country as you do when you go abroad. And maybe it's that connotation of the dirty hands, the country hick, the peasant. But there's nothing more rewarding to me than working in my garden. I have a nice little vegetable garden at home. We're fortunate here in the Northwest. You can actually grow food all year. December and January, things slow down, but you can grow food that you can harvest 12 months of the year here in the climate that we live in.
I think the community garden program of the Parks Department has survived
mm-hmm.
and uses empty lots and
sure.
parts of parks.
Yeah, they're all over town.
Mm-hmm. And they still exist. And this is like what you see in Europe, but it's not nearly on
not
the scale.
Not on the same scale.
Yeah.
Exactly. It'd be nice to see it more accessible.
Is Portland ahead of the curve in terms of American cities?
I can't say for certain. I know a gal, Leslie, that works on that program for the city, and she could tell you the numbers. But I would say from what I've seen, yes, I think there's more community gardens here than most cities I'm familiar with.
You know, as a result, I think of World War II. I don't know if the ordinance is still in the books, but at one time in Portland, there was a law that empty lots could be simply farmed seasonally mm-hmm. by anyone. That is, if you saw an empty lot, you could just, and it wasn't going to be torn up soon, you could just plant a garden there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if that still exists. I bet not. But, you know, it would be interesting to see if maybe a movement that would interest some kind of radical element.
Well, we have a great
to just do that.
A great program here in Portland called Growing Gardens.
Yeah.
Deb Lipholt is the chair for that group. And it's a nonprofit, and they're focused on making gardens accessible to everybody. And anybody who has interest or as far as getting involved with a group like that, helping them build gardens for people who need that help or knows about land or anything of those nature should really get in touch with them because it's beyond just the community gardens program. It's a separate program altogether. It's a nonprofit working on making gardening accessible to all people. So we're fortunate to have those things. But that's the quickest way in many terms.
Growing Gardens.
Growing Gardens is the group.
Well, I want to remind people again, we're listening to KBO 90.7 FM dial. It's me, Joe Uris, and my partner, Abe Proctor. Our guest is Greg Higgins of Higgins Restaurant, and these important announcements.
I got a little biz here.
A little biz?
Yeah, coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 on Between the Covers, the guest is Myla Goldberg, author of Bee Season and Wicket's Remedy, her recent novel set during the 1918 flu epidemic. Maybe topical there.
Ooh, flu epidemic. Coming soon to you, a neighborhood near you.
At Aiden and Abetted by High Fructose Corn Syrup. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with O.B. Hill, Emma Jackson Ford, and Patricia Welch. And at 10, Barbara La Morticella interviews writer Marge Piercy, who will be appearing in Portland this week.
Oh, Marge Piercy's really a good writer, man.
Her newest novel is called Sex Wars. At 10:30 on stage and studio, hear about the first public screening of Bomb Hunters, a film about Cambodia, and part two of a tribute to John Lennon.
You know, those bombs in Cambodia, we left them there.
Yes, we did.
And Agent Orange are our two major gifts to Cambodia. Sorry.
And at 11, Democracy Now! Features a tribute to 35 years of programming on war and peace from WBAI Community Radio in New York City, including a look at Tolstoy's great novel, War and Peace. And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, featuring the state epidemiologist and on Oregon's derailed tobacco addiction prevention efforts, and a live report from the picket line outside McCall Oil.
I don't know anything
coming
about
up today.
I don't either.
Picket
line.
Tune in at 5 and find out.
Okay. Got a lot of people trying to reach us. 231-8187. It is, after all, talk radio. Greg, I got to ask you, man. I go to your restaurant, and the food's tasty. It really is. Very good. And there's a lot of good restaurants in Portland. How do you decide, how do you figure out what to serve and how do you figure the price point? How do you do all that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of variables.
Give me all your secrets.
Everything you need to know about opening a local sustainable restaurant.
I'll do that.
Well, the first thing is better know some good farmers. And that's where we start. Uh-huh. The whole menu planning process is based on the notion that if it's in the garden, then it'll be on the plate. And since we live in this very changeable climate of the Pacific Northwest, this maritime climate that can change week to week, minute to minute sometimes, the products change the same way. And so there might be a forest mushroom available this year that happens to be available with a vegetable that wasn't last year because of a little subtle climate change. So in many ways, the seasonality of the products is determined by the microclimates, and that helps determine how we design the food that we serve. If it comes in, we may just get some new combinations we hadn't thought of in the past, but it's all based on a tradition. We cook primarily in a Western European tradition, French, Mediterranean, sort of those influences, with a few other factors. But that's how the concept of the food comes about. The price of the food is determined by the farmers. We don't dicker. Part of our philosophy is that, you know, the price we're quoted from the farmer is the price we pay, and we don't question that. If we see farms fail, we're going to fail eventually. So we're totally in support of that. And it's the real price of food to keep the business going, to keep the 70 employees we have, you know, living a livable wage. All those things go into the factor of how those prices come together, and it marches on.
So, but that means that, for example, if you buy pork, I can buy it at Safeway or someplace for a couple of bucks a pound.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You're probably paying, what, $5-6 a pound?
I buy the most expensive pork in Portland, I'm proud to say. And it's an organic pork product from Sarah and Joe DeLong in Washington. Mm-hmm. And for loin of pork, which is what we serve most frequently, I pay $8.50 a pound. Yeah, that's my cost. But I believe that, you know, you can pay the farmer, you can pay the doctor, and I'd much rather pay the farmer.
Now, you're in a very competitive business. Do these practices narrow your margins in the end?
Certainly, but I'm a strong believer in that getting quality product that people have poured their passion and their energies into produces a quality product in the end. I can't make a great plate of food out of a mediocre product. A lot of people try, and that's why there's a lot of mediocre restaurants out there. So it starts with that philosophy. Ultimately, the bottom line, we have to get every bit of the utility out of the product that we bring in. So we work very hard to run a very efficient kitchen where there is no waste. But in many ways, I think these products come to you with a higher yield. Yet it's not, you know, a head of romaine lettuce the size of a basketball. It's a tight, compact, beautiful, 100% usable head of lettuce that these people bring me. So I think that and good management practices and good cooking practices makes it possible to be competitive.
You also smoke your own meats, don't you?
Cure and smoke all our meats, make our own prosciutto, salami, make our pickles, make our ketchup, make our vinegar, all that stuff.
So I noticed that, and there's a lot of good restaurants in Portland, but I noticed that some outfits will spin off restaurants. There'll be this place and then another place and then another place. You haven't done that.
I've always questioned the ability to maintain the integrity of the operation when you start opening multiple restaurants in that format. I think my personal style of cooking has created the food at Higgins, and then the vision is shared by my staff, my key staff in the kitchen, who then share it with the rest of the staff. And so we work together very closely in a creative and you know, efficient manner. If we were to open a second restaurant, I don't know that we'd be able to translate that same sort of integrity to the second establishment and maintain it.
Now, a lot of chefs go on, they leave you, and they go on to found their own restaurants. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've noticed this is a pattern in Portland.
I've noticed it, too.
And that must hurt.
Actually, I'm very proud of it. I'm excited to see those guys. When it comes to the point where, I mean, they're like students, and, you know, it's an opportunity to share and watch them grow, and then at a certain point, it's time for them to move forward and express themselves in their own personal way.
Now, I've had a limited experience in commercial cooking and so on. Supposing I came to you, it's very hypothetical. This is not really a job interview, Greg. Supposing I came to you and said, geez, you know, I'd really like to learn how to be a chef. What would you, and you decided for some unknown reason to hire me, how would I begin? Where would I, what would it be?
Well, you know, a good cook, I'm kind of losing my connection here. A good cook is all about asking questions and scrutinizing things. And so it's a process of learning how to ask every question, every step of the way about the integrity of the ingredients, the procedure you're using, the cutting of the product, the uniformity, the method of cooking. So you learn this this dialogue where you ask yourself these questions as you're being taught a thing. And a good chef is a thinking person who's constantly scrutinizing. It's a very, creative and intellectual process to cook well. So that's what we try and teach. We try and teach people how to intrinsically think about what and how they're doing things.
Can a cook make a living?
Absolutely. We've got, I've got 70 people on the staff. About a third of those are in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those people own their own homes. Many of them have families, children, spouses.
So you're paying living
absolutely.
Wages.
That's the commitment in our structure was that we'd have workable schedules and workable wages, or the business couldn't sustain itself, both for my business partner as well as our employees.
I imagine turnover is something that you work against. It hurts you.
Well, we have very little turnover because we take the extra step for our employees to make it as viable an occupation as it can be.
Do they actually have health insurance and stuff
health
like that?
Health insurance. Most of our hourly people work four-day work weeks, three consecutive days off. Our salary people only work 5 days and don't exceed a set number of hours that we feel is a reasonable amount for a salaried manager. And, we try and make it a very family, conscientious business.
Now, given that your vision involves food from local sources and using foods in season, how is this part of the world, how are you situated in terms of that? Is Northwest a good place to be for that sort of vision?
Coming from the frozen tundra of Buffalo, which is where I grew up, this is like a paradise, a cook's paradise. There's a defined seasonality, meaning there's an ever-changing seasonal roster of ingredients to work with, and the quality of those ingredients is unparalleled. I mean, I've traveled all over and cooked all over the world, and rarely do I find anything that reaches the same standards as what we're accustomed to here on a routine basis, albeit that we have a very select group of suppliers and we're very, fortunate in that sense. But as a general sense, when I bring chefs here to Portland and we take them through the markets and that, they're dazzled by what we have to work with.
Now, is cuisine from this area becoming recognized as a distinct regional sort of fare?
Portland's really kind of grown up. In fact, I think in many ways, on a national scale, Portland's viewed ahead of Seattle now as far as what's going on in a pretty well-defined food scene. I mean, each chef has his own personal style, but the quality of ingredients and the integrity which most chefs in the city are applying those ingredients in their own personal spin is very well recognized, and you see that all over national publications and the people who come here looking to enjoy the wines and the food of the region.
You know, when I first encountered a kitchen, I was at Reed College, and I was a poor student, and I got, in every sense, I might add, and I got a job in the kitchen there, and they had just hired this old sea cook, a guy named Larry, short Irish guy, very, very hairy fellow, who liked to wear the, what are called now, wife beater t-shirts.
Mm-hmm. That's a good look.
It's a good look, good look in the
especially
chef.
With the hair.
And sweaty, and an alcoholic. And I learned to cook under his tutelage, and there were these huge, making gravy for
chowder and fish and chips. And
yeah, well, making gravy for what, 700 people or something. Sweat mingling with the flour.
You're making me hungry. This is a family show, man.
With the flour and the oil, And he would, and then of course he got permission from a wonderful woman who ran the whole. Physical operation at Reed, Mary McCabe, gone now, but she's a great woman. She hired him, and he said, the sauces would be much better with a little wine, just a little wine. So she bought some jug wine for us. In fact, she bought a lot of jug wine for us, and we would be working. We'd get the grease and the flour. And we'd be working it, and then adding the liquid. I don't need to tell you this, but, we'd be doing this. And it would be getting thick, and then it would be tasting a little good, And he'd say, lad, do you think it needs a little more wine? And this became a routine list. And I'd say, well, I don't know, Larry, do you think it does? And he said, well, let's see. And he'd go, and he'd grab one of these gallon jugs, and he'd drink a little wine and pour a little in and hand me the wine. I'd drink a little wine. We pour a little more in. It wasn't a bad lifestyle. And you know what? Those sauces enriched with his sweat were pretty good. Now, we had the occasional kitchen fire, it's true, and it was a funky environment, but I did learn to cook there.
That's what we call that old school.
Old school. It's definitely old school cooking, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Heavy on the grease, heavy on the flour,
mm-hmm.
And in his case, heavy on the wine.
Sure.
But the sauces were tasty, and at that time in Portland, the only restaurants, we'd go to Caramico, because they gave me wine underage. It's this wine thing made to come a theme here.
Mm-hmm.
And then what else was there? There was the best restaurant in town, actually, was a very simple restaurant called Jerry's Gables, which I doubt you'd ever heard of.
I think I missed Jerry's Gables.
Yeah, which was one of those surf and turf kind of places.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lobster tail, and you got a big piece of meat.
I think I worked at a couple of those places.
Yeah, they're not uncommon even now. But that was it. There was the London Grill, I think, was a fancy restaurant.
They took me to some of the better places when I first came.
And it was a phony ass restaurant, I have to say. But what I'm thinking about right now is the fact that you and every other restaurateur, good or bad, mediocre or excellent, faces the critics. Now the critics they're not trained. It's not like a school of food criticism or something. There's no real requirement. What is that like? I mean, what's that experience like? Somebody who's, I'm going to guess, 25 or 30 years old, who fancies themselves knowledgeable about eating. Maybe they've spent some time in a couple of restaurants in New York or in L.A. or something.
Hey, man, I've eaten all my life, all right?
Yeah.
Well, you got the first qualification.
Yeah, right. Right. So that puts you in the universal group of humans.
Right. People who eat.
People who eat. Now, I mean, now then suddenly someone's a food critic. Poof, you're a food critic.
Mm-hmm.
And you work for Willamette Week or the Mercury, or the Oregonian, And those papers, the Willamette Week and the Oregonian, actually produce every year a major food guide that has impact, I'm sure, on people going to restaurants.
Oh, absolutely.
And, I mean, how do you relate to that? How do you relate to the fact that this food critic comes into your place possibly a week after you've opened and can murder you or make you a star?
Well, I got to say I've been fortunate in that I haven't been murdered yet, and I'm still standing after 20-some years here. But it certainly can be quite bittersweet, and I don't know that a city that has as many restaurants and as many dedicated chefs and food professionals, and it's the size of Portland, that we wouldn't have one, well-recognized, consistent food writer, restaurant reviewer, we should say, because there's a difference there. It kind of baffles me. I mean, any city of any consequence with a major paper generally has one restaurant reviewer. That's just not how it's done here in Portland, and it's divvied out by committee, and even the Willamette Week has a series of people that write reviews for them. And
see, I want that job, man. I want that job at, like, Willamette Week.
Well, maybe we should have a little taste-off, a city taste-off or something.
Selecting the critic by a fair process, a fair and open process.
See, could be dangerous for the critics.
Very.
So anyhow, the gist of the matter is that they do wield quite a bit of influence. Our personal take on it is to, man the oars and stick to our guns, do what we do best,
mm-hmm.
and hope for the best. And that's borne us pretty well. I think that if there's one thing that I would point out that I think is unfortunate is the sort of provincial tendency to rush to review a restaurant before it's had a chance to resolve itself. And, writing a little piece saying so-and-so is open and they're trying real hard to go check them out, that's one thing. But to write a full-blown review in anything less than a year of operation for a restaurant, I think is ill-advised and unfair to the restaurant because it's a complex process.
Let's say you wait 6 months to a year before you review a place.
Mm-hmm.
How many meals should a critic actually eat at the place before they can make a real evaluation?
I can't imagine that the job can be done very well in less than three visits. I would say my personal rathers would be four or five visits.
Would you have the same meal each time, or would you vary it just to see what the range of the...
Well, certainly, I think you should try several dishes repeatedly just to see what the consistency of the kitchen is,
mm-hmm.
To see if presentation, execution, flavor, texture, all that is consistent. You may have it one time. And if you don't like it all three times, well, then, okay, by all means, you can pan that dish. But I think that there's a lot of subjectivity to it, and I would just like to see... for the sake of those who have suffered at the hands of those bad reviews, maybe a little bit more of a fair shake.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Greg Higgins, Higgins Restaurant. We're talking about restaurants, but we're also talking about the whole issue of food today. And we really haven't touched much on the concept of slow food, which I did want to get into a little bit. The slow food movement, which originated in Italy, essentially argues that one of life's perhaps greatest pleasures, maybe the greatest pleasure, is eating. And that we have, in the modern industrial age, lost, or post-industrial age, lost that pleasure. That we don't look for food that is locally grown, that we don't consider the process of the creation of the food, and the serving of the food, the cooking of the food, and that all of that is lost, and the result of this is that we are less human.
And we don't linger.
We don't link
overeating it.
Yeah, no. There's a, that social element is often completely forgotten about, that aspect of the sort of
But is the slow food movement, this desire for an organic and healthy and place-driven diet, is this slow food movement can it ever be consistent with feeding the vast masses of people on the planet?
Well, I think quite likely. I mean, there's arguments to say that small-scale biointensive agriculture, and there's quite a bit of data on this, is more productive than large-scale factory farming. And you can argue that one on. It's an academic point. But personally, I believe that it can be, and it generally is more productive. And we've gotten away from the pattern where we had urban areas with dense belts of agriculture around them that fed into markets and to feed the people of the city. Instead, now our belts of agriculture can be thousands of miles away. So that's a challenge into whether or not we can preserve the agricultural lands to recreate that kind of model or some portion of that model. When we talk about celebrating artisanal food, which is what slow food is about, and preserving those traditions.
The term artisanal, what is that?
That's when there's either a, it's one step up from the raw product itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's great farmers, there's great orchardists, there's great ranchers, people of that nature. But there are also people who take those products and further embellish them and develop them in the forms of cheeses, breads, beverages, things of that nature. Those are food artisans who actually are taking a raw product and transforming it into a product that has other qualities, whether it would be as a beverage or as a cheese, as a bread, as a, such and such. So, and there's a long tradition to that, to the making of a perfect dry-cured ham, to salamis, to smoking and curing of fish and things like that. And we're a region where there's a lot of those things, and it's no small coincidence, I don't think, that there's such a large chapter of slow food here in Portland. It's one of the biggest chapters in North America, I think, most active groups, because there's so much here to celebrate and recognize for its special nature. But in all of that, I mean, as you were saying that, one thing that struck me is a quote from Wendell Berry that says that we must always remember that eating is an agricultural act. And by choosing, every time you lift your fork and choose your food, you're condoning a certain style of food production in a very subtle way. And consumers underestimate the value and power they have in that. Albeit it's balanced by economic concerns, it's certainly an issue that we have to consider. So I love sitting down and enjoying a perfectly cured sausage and celebrating whoever made that, whether he's in Italy or here, or it's a product that we make at the restaurant or whatnot.
So you like a sausage where you actually know what's in it.
Oh, yeah, I'd like that.
That's a counter to the rule.
Yeah, counter to that whole thing about politics and sausage making, yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
But are you, I have to ask this, are you hopeful? I mean, Jared Diamond seems to be suggesting in the book Collapse that civilizations fall apart out of overly great complexity and, for example, food delivery systems that are extended too far, where paradoxically you're dependent on a very small control group and a vast system with lots of transportation and lots of complexity that is distantly based. It is subject or vulnerable to nature.
It's overextended in that sense, in how he projects sort of those classic examples he shows in Collapse. I think that, curiously, and I'm optimistic that the movement that's going on, the local, seasonal, sustainable food movement, has great potential. And I think that if we can continue to make the progress in the next 20 years we've made in the past 20, that we will really have something to celebrate, a little further down the road here. And I think it'll make exponentially bigger changes than what it's made in these first little, 20 years or so since it's been going on. But in the bigger sense, in the collapse sense, and that thing, I think that the real issue to me is about climate change. And I don't think it's as much about oil as it is about water. And I think that if there's one factor that could wreak total havoc, and it's not going to be just upon one civilization, it's going to be upon, a broad range of issues with population growth at the rate that it's going, and the issues of climate change and the accessibility to water, which generally is a big factor of the world's snowpack. That's where I think that there's a real crux of the issue, is what's going to happen in that sense. If anything's going to drive it, it's going to be the access to water for agriculture.
And possibly the access of petroleum for food transport.
Sure.
That may ultimately, bring something shocking to the American consumer when they're faced with the fact that they can't buy
tropical fruit at the store, or they can't get tomatoes in January.
Well, that those aren't.
And
so
all
serious.
Hell will break loose.
Yeah, that's not so serious. But what about when you can't get bread or spaghetti, or you can't get potatoes, or you can't get the basic foods? And I want to talk a little bit about, short of the coming, and I believe it's real, coming crisis that you've described, just the idea, looking in a positive way, of making good, healthy food affordable. See, I understand that I'm one of the privileged, relatively few, who can afford to spend a significant percentage of our family income on good food. Now, most people really have a kind of a crisis around that. Now, it's true that their disposable income often goes to nonsense,
mm-hmm.
but on the other hand, it really is a challenge. And I think that we have, as a culture, an entitlement to healthy food. And I don't know how that can be realized. Earlier, we had a caller from Independence, a teacher, who talked about the fact that the schools there have a bad, you know, bad lunchroom diet. And we suggested, and he thought it was a good idea, that maybe the curriculum should be altered to create a small farming project, since they're in Independence, which is a rural area. Things like that are small solutions that might really work, but there has to be a real movement around that. There has to be not just people who are supporting slow foods, not just people who go to good restaurants, not just people who buy beef from the healthy co-op. There's got to be a real demand. People have to be screaming and yelling about the adulteration of food, about the GMO process, about all the nastiness that industry is pushing on us. And I don't see that. I don't see that in the mainstream politics at all. Where's the Democrats? Where's the Republicans? Where's the whatever? I mean, there's so much coming at us constantly.
It's clear that we all know that you know, there's big forces that pull out of the strings in Washington. And obviously, when some of these multinational corporations that are controlling the food supply have their voices heard, it's not in public, it's in the back rooms, mm-hmm. Before and after the elections to achieve some of the policy that they're looking for. But I don't think that we can underestimate the consumer initiative, what you're speaking of, people saying, I'm not going to buy GMO groceries. I'm not going to buy this product that I don't even know what country it comes from. I mean, isn't it kind of a crime that we can't even have country of label or origin, country of origin labeling in this country?
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
I'm,
it is weird.
I'm
really
baffled.
Weird.
I mean, what is the motivation behind denying that bit of...
Because we have multinational corporations doing the food business. Let's go to... I think we have time for one more caller. Do you mind?
Sure.
One more? Let's go out there to somebody. Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Right. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Oh, no. It's a KBOO moment.
Oh.
I that's my new term. We have a lot of issues. Look, Greg, I want to be hopeful about the food issue. I want to think that Americans can wake up and feed themselves well. I want to believe that people will start, you know, in their backyards growing their own vegetables in a healthy way. I want to think that the animals that are processed for us are humanely raised and humanely killed, and the meat is processed appropriately. But I know, as you suggest, that there are vast forces at work, ranging from human greed to the realities of a changing environment, which is also, I think, driven to a great extent,
sure,
by human greed. And I, you know, when we talk to you, you have a lovely restaurant. I like to go there to eat. But that's a drop in the bucket. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's really a drop in the bucket. Do you foresee a change in public awareness and attitude?
It's steady and clear cut, but I have to qualify that in saying that I have a specific clientele, many of whom I've been cooking for 20 years or so here in Portland. So we continue. It's somewhat, you know, the choir, me cooking for the choir in that sense. I think it's growing. I think that we're seeing just the incidence of the growth of natural grocery chains here in the Portland area, growth of farmers markets here in the Portland area, the efforts to get better food into the schools, the fact that you're hearing noise about that and that people are active in it makes me optimistic. And I think that we can make some significant changes there. But as you say, we need more people pulling on it.
Greg Higgins, thank you very much for being with us. I hope we didn't bore you too much.
Pleasure.
We'll see you all, and we want you all to keep on keeping on. Next week, we're going to get back to our horrific tales of woe.
Tell us where your restaurant is, real quick.
Broadway and Jefferson, downtown Portland.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, guys.
It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Welcome to the Tuesday Morning Radio Zine. First on Between the Covers, Julie Sabatier's guest is Myla Goldberg, author of Bee Season and Wicket's Remedy, her recent novel set during the 1918 flu epidemic. At 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with O.B. Hill, Emma Jackson Ford, and Patricia Welch. At 10, Barbara LaMorticella interviews writer Marge Piercy, who will be appearing in Portland this week. Her newest novel is called Sex Wars. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, hear about the first public screening of Bomb Hunters, a film about Cambodia, and part two of a tribute to John Lennon. And at 11, Democracy Now! Features a tribute to 35 years of programming on war and peace from WBAI, community radio in New York City, including a look at Tolstoy's great novel, War and Peace. And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, featuring the state epidemiologist on Oregon's derailed tobacco addiction prevention efforts, and a live report from the picket line outside McCall Oil. Now let's go to Between the Covers.
This is Julie, and I'm here with Myla Goldberg, the author of Bee Season, and her new book is Wicket's Remedy, which is a novel that takes place during the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. So I understand you took 5 years to write the book.
Yeah, it took a long time. This is 5 years of full-time writing. I mean, when I was doing Bee Season, my first novel, I had a day job, and I was only writing part-time, like 2 or 3 days a week, and it still only took 2 years. And so in retrospect, I know I had it easy with that one. This was, yeah, a lot of work.
And a lot of research, I imagine.
That was really fun, but yeah, a lot of research. Because I didn't know dookie about any of these things. Like, I didn't know anything about 1918 or the flu epidemic or what life was like then, and so everything had to emerge from the research. So my plot, my setting, my characters all came from the kind of, I basically did the first 6 months, I would probably guess, was just like research intensive, not much writing, a lot of reading and note taking and thinking. And then from then on, the writing began.
So since you didn't know anything about this before, how did the idea come to you?
It just came to me while I was kind of fishing for my next, you know, book idea. I knew I was ready to kind of launch into another big project. And I was reading the New York Times one day, and it was an article that listed the 5 worst epidemics of all time. And the 1918 influenza epidemic was listed among them, and I'd never heard of it. And I was like, well, if it's so bad, how come I don't know what this is? And so the more research I did, the more I came fascinated not only with the events of the epidemic, which are just catastrophic and horrific and just I've never heard of anything like that happening before, but also the fact that it pretty much had been erased from public consciousness. And so this book for me kind of became an exploration of memory and its failings on both sort of an individual and a collective level, and that just kind of became a very compelling topic for me.
Yeah, interesting. And how did the story kind of develop out of the research? You said you didn't really have a plot going into it, and I know that some of the, at least the stuff on Gallup's Island, mm-hmm. was from an actual research study.
Yeah. So basically my research suggested what I wanted to write about. There's a throwaway sentence in a book about the flu about experiments that had been done on human subjects. And I was like, whoa, hold the phone. What do you mean experiments on human subjects? What's that? So I researched that and I realized that, yes, I definitely had to have that be in the book. And then Boston as a setting came about because that was one of the epicenters of the epidemic and of its spread. Soldiers leaving the United States to go fight in Europe brought the flu with them in a milder form to Europe. It got worse in Europe because it was in the trenches, passing from soldier to soldier. And then they brought it back all through the port of Boston, which was a major, area for soldiers. And so the combination of those two things, these outrageous experiments, and then Boston as like a main vector for its spread, gave me my setting. And then everything just kind of sprang from that. It was a very sort of organic process.
Yeah. And the main character in Wicked Sermody, Lydia, is mm-hmm. such a compelling character with such a distinct voice to her. And she's kind of got this, she walks the beat of a different drummer kind mm-hmm. of feel to her. I'm wondering, how were you able to capture that? How were you able to develop such a concrete character in a time that's so different from you and also a place that's different?
It was a huge challenge. And the first time I tried to do it, I didn't get it right. Lydia Kilkenny is the main character of this story. She's born into a South Boston Irish Catholic working class family. She grows up in a tenement, and that's a community where you're expected to stick around, like you're born into it and you're expected to stay there, and she didn't want that. She wanted something bigger for herself. But as I was exploring her the first time around when I was trying to write this book, I was kind of focusing on our differences. Like, I'm a nice Jewish girl from a middle class family, late 20th, early 21st century, and so she and I just seemed like total opposites. And I was writing, my fixation on the differences prevented me from making her real the first time through, and I actually had a completed draft. I was like 2.5 or 3 years into the process, and I had a finished draft, and I thought, okay, cool, everything's moving along. And I gave it to a couple friends to read it, and they read it, and they're like, this isn't very good. And I thought, what do you mean? And I looked at it, and they were right, and my characters were dead on the page, and it was because I'd been focusing on the wrong things. And so the second time around, I basically trashed that draft. Like, I'd come up with a plot I liked, but I knew I had to develop it in an entirely different way and get into my characters in a different way. And so the second time around, I tried to look at Lydia and I in terms of what our similarities are. And I realized that we shared ambition, motivation, and curiosity. And once I had those as footholds to get inside this character and kind of bring her to life, it made all the difference. And then I was able to write it in what I think is a more kind of vibrant, human, warm-blooded way.
Well, she's definitely alive on the page, for okay. sure. It's nice to have those friends, though, who will tell you.
Oh, my God. You absolutely need friends who love you enough to tell you when you suck, because if you don't have them, it's not going to work.
Yeah. So how much were you able to draw on your own experience for the book?
For fiction to be effective, you need to instill your own experience into it. It's a tricky thing because, one of the very first things you're taught in Creative Writing 101 is write what you know. But I think one of the biggest problems with fiction today is that is interpreted too conservatively and too strictly. And so you've got people writing about their boyfriends and their breakups and I can't think of a more boring thing to do. I think, to me, the maxim, write what you know, is talking about instilling aspects of your experience into your fiction. It's not a literal situation. And so a couple things ended up kind of surprising me by what I was able to do. I had begun this book in 2000, before 9/11, before we went to war. And then I'm writing about the beginning of World War I, where a country starts at peace and then goes to war. And all of a sudden, that started happening around me. And so what had first began as a research project actually turned into a project where I was able to look around me and see what happens to a country when it goes to war. see the changes, see the birth of like a kind of rabid form of nationalism and patriotism that I had never experienced in my life. And so I was able to translate those experiences to the page in this book, and I found that was kind of both a frightening and fascinating experience at the same time. And then I guess when the 1918 influenza epidemic strikes, Lydia becomes compelled with the idea that she has to do something to help. You know, she's compelled by the idea that she can't just sit around. And that also, I was able to use my personal experience with that. I live in New York City, and so when 9/11 happened, I wasn't able to write anymore. There was a very long period where I didn't see what the point was. I didn't see how that was helping anything, and I ended up finding ways to volunteer and to try to help out, you know, with what was going on in the aftermath. And so that experience was one that I felt able to translate to some degree to Lydia's experience when she feels compelled to start volunteering in a hospital. And so for me, the way that real life manifests in fiction is sort of in this more subtle way where there's stronger filters, but the root of the experience, the root of an emotion or the root of an observation can get in.
Mm-hmm. And, there is this kind of, as you were saying, a rampant kind of a sinister sort of patriotism, mm-hmm. that to the each chapter ends with a newspaper article from the Times, and those are actual newspaper
articles.
Those
are all genuine newspaper articles.
And they're kind of, some of them are kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
In their voice, in just what they're talking about. I mean, one of my favorites is the woman who stops planting a certain kind of flower
in
her garden.
Because it was the Kaiser's favorite flower, and so she tears them all out of her garden. Yeah, that's a favorite, my absolute favorite, and I think it's my favorite because the same thing. I saw the same thing happening here. There's a newspaper article in the book that talks about this German guy who's like arrested because they're thinking he's a spy, and they're thinking this based on nothing. Like, he has a checkbook where he wrote a very large check, and he's found with a suitcase, and it turns out he's just a regular working day Joe, and like the article explains this, but there's no difference between that and what was happening, you know, right after 9/11 and into still, you know, now that we're in the war with Iraq, with you know, Muslims getting just pulled over and being thought suspicious just because of how they look. And it's the same thing, you know, we're no different. I mean, it's the tragedy of human nature is the fact that our foibles are our foibles and we're stuck with them. They just kind of manifest in different ways from historical period to historical period.
Yeah. And there is this kind of parallel to Guantanamo Bay when you think about prisoners on an island.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously it's not the same conditions at all.
No, by no stretch.
They're not. The conditions on Gallup's Island are, you know, it's a health clinic, but they're infecting people with the disease on purpose.
Yeah.
And they're, the doctors, everybody except for Lydia, basically, is mm-hmm. not treating them like they're human beings.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, and it's an interesting situation. And yeah, I did research it. Basically, every single test that is conducted in this book is an actual test that was conducted on the island for real. I tracked down the government documentation of these tests undertaken on prisoners. And it's some outrageous stuff. And it was all done. I mean, everyone thought they were doing the good thing. I mean, it was not a Tuskegee situation. These guys, it was informed consent. They knew what they were getting into, and yet they still wanted to do it. And, you know, medicine, the state of medicine was such that, you know, some of the tests that they're doing to a modern eye are just outrageous. Like, how could they possibly think that this would do anything except make people, you know, physically uncomfortable? And so it was a fascinating thing to kind of delve into.
And the study was unsuccessful, wasn't it? I mean, both in the book and in reality.
Yeah, not to give too much away about the story. But, yeah, I mean, that's the other fascinating thing, is they didn't know how it worked, and they didn't know how to transmit the flu, and they tried their darndest, but it eluded them, as, you know, the flu to many degrees still does elude us, you know, on a medical and scientific level.
And so were you thinking about avian flu at all when you were writing this?
Well, I mean, this has been in the process for, as I said, 5 years. And 5 years ago, no one was thinking or talking about avian flu. So the fact that this book is coming out just when avian flu happens to start being in the news is just a very strange coincidence. But one thing that did strike me as I began writing this book is I noticed that every fall there was something in the news about the flu, and something that, like, you know, the media was trying to get us scared about. Like, last year it was, oh, there's only 5 doses of vaccine for the whole country, and it's going to be bad this year. And it wasn't. It ended up that it was just fine. I think the news about the flu this year is a little more legit. I mean, the avian flu is a fascinating thing, and one of these days it's probably going to turn into something we have to watch out for. I don't think it's going to happen this year or anything, so there's no reason to be frightened. But I'm awfully glad they're starting to pay attention to the infrastructure that needs to be in place for when it does, you know, come about. But no, I wasn't thinking about, you know, topicality in that regard at all. It was just a weird coincidence.
So do you find yourself feeling more aware of the implications when you read things about avian flu, like sort of sorting out the stuff that's based on fear from the stuff that's maybe more, you know, logistical?
Yeah, I mean, I feel I do have, because I've spent so much time reading about the flu and thinking about the flu. I mean, I read all these books on epidemiology, and none of that got into my novel, but it was really fun to read for me. So I do have maybe a bit of a leg up to be able to sort what's just the fear talk and what's legitimate talk. I mean, the legitimate talk is the fact that these scientists were able to recreate this virus in a lab, and that is just way cool. They understand it so much better than they did before, but just because we as a, you know, an animal, the human species understand something better doesn't mean that all of a sudden it's now going to like strike and like, you know, be this big bad thing. We love to think that we're in control of things, and we're just not. And one of the things we have the least control over is disease. Like something like the flu, we have no control over at all. Avian flu has been around for time immemorial, and it's going to continue to be around, and we can't predict when it's going to be bad or if it's going to be bad. You know, probability says yes, there's going to be another really bad one, and hopefully because of advances made in, you know, the past few months and the past year, we'll be able to handle it better than they did in 1918.
Yeah, well, it's much more of a risk now because we live in such a smaller world.
Yeah, you know, you've got airplanes, you've got trains, you've got all sorts of interconnectivity that wasn't there before. So it's certainly going to spread faster than it did then, although the war was a huge help with that. You had as much interconnectivity as you could have had given the time period in 1918 because of that.
Yeah, definitely. So writing about influenza, writing about an epidemic of any kind, you have to kill off a lot of characters.
Yes, you do. Let us not give away which characters die off,
certainly
though, shall
not,
we?
No. But was that difficult for you? I mean, introducing people, even minor characters,
right,
that you get kind of attached to.
Well, I mean, it was difficult in the sense that I wanted to make sure I did it right. I didn't want to treat any of my characters casually, and for me a big aspect of this book was I wanted to treat loss the way that loss, you know, deserves to be treated. And so writing it with kind of the delicacy that I felt it needed to be approached, that was the challenge. But was it actually hard killing a character off? No, it wasn't. I mean, like, it's kind of, I'm God when I'm writing a book. It is my world, and there's a certain thrill that comes with being able to do that, even when you kill but not really excellent character off. There is a certain thrill I have to admit that comes with being able to do that.
And do you know ahead of time when you're creating that character, oh, this one's not going to make it?
Some yes, some no. I mean, the fun for me with writing is finding out what's going to happen next. And often I do have the large-scale events in my head. I know that one's going to lead to the other, and I generally don't know how I'm going to get between, say, point A and point E. It's the B, C, D that I figure out along the way. But, yeah, often for the biggies, I kind of knew that it was going to be happening.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we won't talk too much about that. We'll leave people to pick
right
up their own copy of Wicked's Remedy. So you also have this this great concept in the book of the chorus of the dead,
mm-hmm,
that speaks in the margins. So I think that's a really awesome concept, and it does address this issue of memory and
exactly
how things are not remembered the way they happen necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how that idea came about?
Sure. Well, a book that I read quite a long time ago now, but that made a huge impression on me, was this book Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov, which when you open it up, it looks like an epic poem that's annotated. And as you read, you discover that the novel lies in the annotations. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. And I sort of did, you know, note to self, someday do a book that has extra text things. And so then as I was writing this book and like approaching it from the perspective of memory's fallibility, it occurred to me that, oh, this is it. What a great chance to, like, if you have extra voices coming in and challenging the primacy of this, you know, your main story, what a wonderful way to allow your reader to experience firsthand the idea that memory is not to be trusted. And so it just evolved from that spark.
That's great. Because you have, you're reading along and it's sort of written in the, what English majors would call, the third person limited. So it's not exactly written from Lydia's perspective,
right,
but it's limited to what she remembers.
Exactly.
Basically.
Exactly.
And then you've got her, the chorus of the dead, everybody from, you know, people she actually knew to people who were just acquaintances of hers passing, you
mm-hmm
know, people she passed on the street remembering things
mm-hmm
differently.
Yeah. I mean, and to me that speaks to the idea of our identities are inexorably tied up in our memories. I mean, we are who we are based on what we think we remember about ourselves and what we think we did. But you never know if you get it right. And, you know, everyone's had the experience of you're with grandma, and, you know, she's telling this long story about, oh, and then that really wonderful soda shop used to be on the corner. And then grandpa's like, oh, no, no, it was 5 blocks away. What are you talking about? And they just become violent in these arguments, you know, trying to figure it out, because it's all very important. The little things, they seem petty, but we cling to them. They form the core of who we are. And so I love the idea of addressing that, you know, with these margin notes.
Yeah, and there is a kind of, it leaves the reader, you know, still wanting to trust the narrative voice, but
right.
at the same time realizing that it's flawed as we all are, you
exactly.
know, as human beings.
Yeah, nothing's perfect.
Yeah, it's a wonderful detail.
Thank you.
Would you mind reading a little bit?
Not at all, no.
I don't know if you have a section picked out that you'd like to read from.
Sure, I can read, well, I'll give you, do you want to hear about the early days before the flu has started, or do you want to hear a bit from when she's in the hospital and... working with the
I enjoyed the whole book, quite honestly. So I just read it in the last week or so, and
cool.
I really loved delving into it. So
right. I'll do a bit from the beginning when things are still happy, and she's working at the department store. So I'm going to read a portion. Lydia Kilkenny is still Lydia Kilkenny. She has not yet married Henry Wickett and become Lydia Wickett, and she has left the small environment of Southie. Most of her friends, when they graduated eighth grade along with her, got jobs behind sewing machines and in factories, but she took herself downtown, went across the bridge to get a job in Gilchrist's department store. For 4 years, Lydia worked behind a lustrous wood counter on the store's ground level, amid polished marble floors and hanging crystal lamps. Gilchrist's Tiffany Rotunda gazed down from three levels above like an emerald eye. Inside her starched white shirtwaist, her hair piled into a careful bun, she felt as if her best self looked just beneath her skin, a shining, shimmery fish that might breach the surface at any moment. Standing before a selection of men's shirts and a dazzling array of colored fabric, she could eye a man's collar size, budget, and tastes in a glance, and knew, just by looking, the thread count of a cotton shirt or the origins of a piece of silk. Even after 4 years, she thrilled at sealing a customer's payment into a pneumatic capsule and sending it to the cashier for change. Miles and miles of pneumatic tubing crisscrossed Gilchrist's walls and ceilings. Capsules left men's furnishings on a current of compressed air to travel over silks and velvets, over embroideries and trimmings, past veilings, and past black and colored dress goods. Lydia pictured her customers' sales slips speeding past counter girls whispering among themselves in millinery, past the solitary sales girl at umbrellas who every day prayed for rain. Lydia once visited the cashier's office just to see the veritable pipe organ of commerce, where each capsule arrived with a thunk, its contents scrutinized by a woman whose hands were bound to smell like money. Lydia wondered if the woman scrubbed the scent from her fingers each night, or if her dreams wafted with visions of wealth. Whenever Lydia retrieved a returning capsule containing a customer's correct change, she felt the cold, dry breath of the tube tickle the back of her hand. On slow days, she hearkened to Gilchrist's pneumatic exhalations. After 4 years, she still marveled at the notion that money pumped through the store no less fervently than the blood in her veins.
Thank you. There's so much in there that deals with details. It's clear that, you know, you've got this idea of the tubing. You know, that was a completely foreign concept to me.
I was so into it. When I first learned about department stores of that era and the pneumatic tubes, I just thought that was the coolest thing ever.
Do you know what the reasoning behind that is? Like, why they did that? Because...
Oh, it was incredibly efficient. You know, I mean, these stores were massive. You know, these department stores are much grander even than the ones that we have today. And so, you know, they didn't want everyone handling money. You know, they didn't trust. You know, there was not a lot of trust going on with the sales force. I mean, these were people, literally every person who worked in a department store in 1918 was patted down when they left the store every night to check against theft. I mean, they were treated like animals, basically. And so by consolidating the money, they didn't have to worry about theft. And this was an incredibly efficient way to do it. I mean, the mail service used pneumatic tubing for quite some time in the early part of the 20th century. It was a very speedy way to go. So,
yeah.
And in fact, research libraries, specifically the New York Public Research Library, still uses pneumatic tubes. It's a closed stack situation, so if you want something to read, you have to fill out a call slip. They stick the call slip in a capsule, send it in a pneumatic tube, and then send it down to the bowels of the library to, like, get your book for you. I mean, it's a good system.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something that sets Lydia apart from the rest, from the world around her.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be like she's more human almost than anyone else. Like, she's more able to sort of appreciate these small details, like the pneumatic tubing that's just kind of a part of her everyday life,
mm-hmm,
and that kind of thing. And when she starts treating patients, that comes out in a different way.
Yeah.
How did that sort of develop over time? Or
when your challenge of creating a main character is you do want someone that's going to stick with your reader, and you have to come up with things that are going to help them do that. And again, I think this might have to do with you need to find common ground between yourself and your characters without making characters who are just, you know, reflections of yourself. And so one thing that I notice little things. I notice the little details in life, and I enjoy noticing them and describing them. So having a main character who notices them, too, gives me an outlet to be able to explore those little details. But, I mean, also just speaking to Lydia on, I mean, I think in every age, you know, there are people who just, they have this weird kind of, they have motivation to do things above and beyond what most people are motivated to do. And that's certainly the case with Lydia. I mean, most people, and certainly, I mean, for her gender, it was difficult to kind of break out of expectations placed upon you. But I mean, for anyone who wants to do something different, you not only need the desire to do something different, but you need the energy and the motivation to get yourself there. And I think that often is tied to taking a little closer notice of the world around you, because that's your inspiration. I think people who tend to pay attention to stuff a little bit more are the people who are driven to want to see more and do more, because there are these little details that are, like, you know, kind of driving them forward. So
I'm talking with Myla Goldberg about her new book, Wicket's Remedy, about the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic and many other things. In contrast to Lydia, the main character, there's also this other ambitious character named Quentin Driscoll.
Yes.
And he's such an interesting character, in that most of his story comes out in these documents that appear at the end of the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
These letters, the QD Soda Factory newsletter,
mm-hmm,
etc. And he comes out as a sort of a morally ambiguous guy.
He's flawed, let's just put it that way. Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting... I don't tend to like books that have characters that just kind of, it's all very straightforward. Oh, that's the good guy and that's the bad guy. And the thing that fascinates me about Quentin Driscoll is I think at heart, he and Lydia are very similar. They're both very ambitious. They're both very motivated. They're trying to create something for themselves that's larger than what they started with. But Quentin Driscoll makes some pretty fundamental errors in judgment earlier on in his career that basically poison the rest of his career. And he's able to kind of skirt them for a very long time, but they do eventually come back to haunt him. But I wanted to make him a guy that was appealing on a basic level, and so you could, like, see where, you know, he kind of got into trouble. I mean, he's a man who invents a myth about himself that then he comes to believe. You know, he starts telling a lie, and he tells that lie often enough that that lie becomes truth. That is something that fascinates me. I think it's something that everyone does on sometimes on very small levels, but on varying degrees. We all tell ourselves stories about ourselves or about our families or about our histories that eventually we come to believe because we want them to be true when, you know, maybe they're not. But it's so much more appealing to think that it might be true. And that's what Quentin Driscoll does here. And it's a huge mistake. But I think it's a very human mistake, and I think it's one that we can all understand.
Yes, and you do treat him with this, I mean, he's kind of this sleazy sort of corporate character, but he's treated with a kind of humanity, you know, just like the rest of the characters.
Thanks.
Yeah, and he really does, you sort of feel for him, and you go, ooh, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, you asked a bunch of great questions.
Okay.
I think we're covered.
One more question.
Yeah.
Just a bonus question for you. What's it like to be the subject of a Decemberist song?
It's cool, man. Yeah, that was one of the most pleasant surprises that I've ever gotten kind of out of the blue. I had no idea that they were writing a song about me. And, like, I just had someone sent me an email saying, hey, this band wrote a song about you. I was like, oh, nah, you know. But I went to the record store and I found the album, and there it was. And I took it home and listened to it. And I kind of, the first time I heard it, I was sort of smiling and blushing simultaneously and not really knowing what to do with my hands. And just kind of, no, it's pretty cool.
Have you met the Decemberists or seen them in concert?
It turns out, well, I had met the last time I was in Portland for Bee Season. I met Colin Malloy then, the singer-songwriter guy, and it was, I guess, after that meeting that he decided he wanted to write a song. And he had to remind me of that, embarrassingly enough. I, like, wrote an email to the website saying, hey, guys, thanks for the nice song. And he's like, hey, Milo, we met, you know, back in Portland. It's like, oh, cool, okay. It's really, really cool. It's slick.
So hopefully they'll be reading Wicked's Remedy and maybe come up with another
song.
Oh,
one is enough. One is more than enough.
So you're enjoying your time in Portland?
Oh, sure. I love this place. I actually lived here for a summer when I was in college and had a great time. And Powell's, where I'm reading, is one of my very favorite bookstores, you know, in the country. So being able to come back here and go back to that store is always fun.
Thanks for talking with me
today.
Oh,
thanks for having me. This is fun.
Wicked's Remedy. And I hope the rest of your day is relaxing. And
thank you.
I've been speaking with Mila Goldberg, the author of Wicked's Remedy, a novel about the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic and many, many other things. For KBOO in Portland, this is Julie Sabatier.
It's 9:30. This is KBOO, your community-owned radio station on 90.7 FM. Up next on the radio zine, we have Black Book Talk, the monthly show focusing on books written by Black authors. And stay with us at 10 when Barbara Lamorticella interviews writer Marge Piercy about her newest novel, Sex Wars. And then at 10:30 on Stage and Studio, Dime Roberts features a new film about the bomb hunters in Cambodia, and we'll hear part two of the John Lennon tribute. Coming up now, Black Book Talk.
Kwanzaa, a step to unity. Kwanzaa, a step to being free. Kwanzaa, help us to see that we are in control of our destiny. Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa, a step to unity.
Kwanzaa,
a step to being free.
Kwanzaa,
help us to see that we are in control of our destiny.
Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa, a step to unity.
Kwanzaa,
a step to being free.
Kwanzaa,
help us to see that we are in control of our destiny.
Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Good morning. And welcome to Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch of Multnomah County Library here in the studio. Joining me by phone is Emma Jackson Ford, our bookwoman. Let's see, Emma, are you on the line now?
I am here. Good morning.
Okay, our third member, O.B. Hill, won't be with us today, but I'm sure he's here with us in spirit. As always on our December program, we will tell you a little bit about some Kwanzaa books, but you know something? We do that every year. We hope that we've let you know that, you know, books and tapes and videos on this subject are available in your local bookstores, in your libraries, hopefully in your school libraries, but absolutely in your public libraries. So we are not going to devote the whole show to that, but we will give you some titles. And we're also going to talk about some books that we hope that you will think of either as gifts for yourself or for others. So Emma, what you been reading? Anything good? What do you want to share with us first?
I want to start with my first Kwanzaa book.
Okay.
It's a book suitable for kindergarten through third grade. It's written by Deborah M. Newton Chocolate, and it's illustrated by Cal Massey. It's a beautiful book with the family on the cover lighting the Kanara, the seven candles for Kwanzaa. And this book actually is here in our school library, so I'm sure other schools have it. It's a beautiful book that has very easy reading. It starts with, when Mama says it's Kwanzaa time, Daddy helps me dress up in an African shirt. Mama dresses like an African queen. And in the corner on each page, they have the date, starting December 26th, and they have the day, Umoja. Then for the 27th, they have December 27th, and they show you which candle to light, and that's Kuji Chagalia. And on each page, a different member of the family comes in for the celebration. They put up a Kwanzaa, a red, black, and green flag. And they have musical instruments, and they talk about the food. And in the back, they have symbols and words used during Kwanzaa. So it's an excellent book. It's suitable for introducing Kwanzaa to a child, kindergarten through third grade. It's beautifully illustrated. It's called My First Kwanzaa Book. It's written by Deborah M. Newton Chocolate, illustrated by Cal Massey, and it is distributed by Scholastic Books.
Okay, I'm always looking for new sources of information. In the past, I've sort of gone through the collection at my branch, North Portland branch of the library, and pulled the books that we have there. But, of course, I know there's lots more that we don't have. So I decided this time around I was going to see what the Internet offered in terms of information on books. And I went to what is a new site for me, or at least one that I've only been to once or twice before. It is www.blackbooksgalore.com. And again, I think if you just go to Google or something and put in Black Books Galore, you'll certainly get to it. It's a children's book service, and you can find out about books at this site, and you can also purchase books. They have a site, a website for children for Christmas and Kwanzaa books. And they say that, you know, each of the books is beautifully illustrated and appropriate for children. And there are about 12. That they have, they're not all Kwanzaa books, but among the Kwanzaa titles are K is for Kwanzaa, a Kwanzaa alphabet book by Juwanda G. Ford. And I think this is one, I'm sure this is one, that we have mentioned before. But it's a good book when you're, for children who are learning their alphabet. It teaches them about the holiday, and it also teaches them about that. And there's also The Gifts of Kwanzaa, which is by Cynthia St. Or maybe it's Cynthia. I'm not quite sure the pronunciation of her first name. Cynthia St. James. And this book, besides telling about Kwanzaa, is just an absolutely beautifully illustrated book. Any of you who have purchased the Kwanzaa stamps around this time of year have seen work by Cynthia St. James, and you've probably seen it in other places. So if you want some lovely art in your home as well as information about Kwanzaa, then you certainly want to go to this site. There's also a Kwanzaa celebration, a pop-up book. When it comes to pop-up books, I'm about 5 years old. I love them. And I know children do, too. So if you want a book that you can enjoy and your children will, too, then I'd recommend a Kwanzaa celebration, a pop-up book by Nancy Williams, illustrated by Robert Sabuda. Emma, anything else you want to mention on the Kwanzaa line?
Not in the Kwanzaa line, but I wanted to say that I happen to have a book right here on my desk called Sunday Best, and it's by Juwanda G. Ford. I thought that was a little coincidental. It's a book about dressing up for Sunday, of course. It's also distributed by Scholastic Books, and it's a book that's suitable for third through fifth grade. It starts out with Monday through Friday. We do almost the same thing every day. Early in the morning, Mom leaves for work, then Dad takes my sister and me to school. Late in the afternoon, Dad hurries off to his job. Mom rushes home. She makes sure we let her know if we have any homework. I like something about every day of the week. I like pizza on Monday. My school has really good pizza. I like piano lessons on Tuesday, and it goes on like that until we get to Sunday. And on Sunday, but Sundays are really different. On Sundays, we do everything best. We eat our biggest and best breakfast of the week. We put on our best clothes, our Sunday best. Dad and I both wear ties, and it shows the dad tying the tie, and the mom and the daughter on the next page looking in the mirror, and they're in their Sunday best. I thought this was a wonderful book, even for children past fifth grade, because the trouble with children dressing appropriately doesn't end then. It's kind of nice to have something like that that's not so personal that you can point to.
Yes.
So this book is called Our Sunday Best. It's by Juwanda G. Ford. It's illustrated by Colin Boothman, and it's distributed by Scholastic Books.
Okay. I want to simply mention another book that I don't have in hand, but it just sounded like such a good book. It's called The Carol of the Brown King, Nativity Poems by Langston Hughes, illustrated by Ashley Bryan. Apparently, Ashley Bryan was reading some works by Langston Hughes and came across these four poems that had to do with Christmas and thought that it would be good to do a poem about them. And I have to admit, I was intrigued simply by the title and the cover art, which has a brown king. And, of course, it says very specifically that one of the kings in the Bible was dark, probably, it seems to me, in that area of the world. They all were. But at any rate, it's wonderful that there's a poem that says this for children, and that all of these poems are, since they're by Langston Hughes, certainly ones that I think African-American children and all of us will enjoy. So if you would like to remind your children of the color of the people who were probably there at the birth of Christ, then I think you'll want Carol of the Brown King, Nativity Poems by Langston Hughes, illustrated by Ashley Bryan, whose last name is spelled B-R-Y-A-N. Again, I want to refer people back to this Black Books Galore site because there are a number of books here, some other great Christmas books, and since Kwanzaa, and I always want to remind people this, Kwanzaa does not cancel out Christmas. It's not the alternative. It can be the alternative if you don't choose to celebrate Christmas, but Christmas is on December 25th, and Kwanzaa starts on December 26th. So certainly for those who want to celebrate both, this Christmas and Kwanzaa book site is a very good place to go. Let's see. I also want to refer people to Black Issues Book Review. I really ought to be on the staff of this magazine because I refer to it a great deal. But it's just such a wonderful source of information on books and other formats of materials about African Americans, and you learn about book clubs, and I get the magazine in print, both at the library and at my home. But, again, it's wonderful to see what you can find online. And we're all kind of rushing nowadays, and we don't have as much time as we used to, or I certainly don't feel that I do. So if you need to, say, take your lunch break and do some of your holiday shopping or at least holiday reviews of things, then you can jump on the Internet and go to Black Issues Book Review site, which is www.bibookreview.com. So it's simply www.b for black, I for issues, and then bookreview.com. And in looking through this month's issue, they will give you a list of recommended books. One of the first things they mention this year are best photography books. And we all laugh about coffee table books, but then again, I know when I was growing up, I loved and still do love those big format books to have great photographs of things and places and people that you want to meet, and hopefully you'll get there, but if you don't, you can travel through the book. So I hope that people will take a chance to look at some of the titles or the information on some of the titles that they're recommending. One is America on the Ropes, the Pictorial History of the Johnson-Jeffries Fight. And this is the story of the famous fight between prize fighter Jack Johnson, the man with the golden arm, and James Jeffries, the Great White Hope. So the whole story of that fight, what led up to it, what happened afterwards, and the fight itself is shown in this book. PBS rebroadcast a biography of Jack Johnson a few months ago, and I really hadn't watched it the first time around, but I did this time, and I was so interested in finding out what a Renaissance man Jack Johnson was, because that's an aspect that's never talked about. So because of the interest that was piqued by that television series, I'm going to be very interested in seeing this book, and I am encouraging others to look at this and also look at some other titles that are on the Black Issues Book Review website.
Wow. That sounds wonderful. I've got to go onto that website.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to talk about a few other things from there, but it really is great.
Well, in the middle of winter, sometimes I like to get away, and I know the children like to get away. So sometimes I find books that are about summer. This book is not necessarily about summer, but it's about a place that's summery. It's called Caribbean Dream, and it's by Rachel Isadora. Inside the book, there's a little poem. I remember a far tall island floating in cobalt paint. The thought of it is a childhood dream. And that's by Phyllis Shan Alfrey. There's a beautiful overview picture of the Caribbean. And I think I like this poem, I like this book not just because of the words in it, but I love the illustrations. There are little children, little black faces with beautiful eyes and beautiful braids looking out at you from just like maybe someone took a photograph of groups of children and then watercolored it in the book. Mm. It starts, where morning meets light, we rise. Where friends meet friends, we smile. Where sound meets color, we hide. And here people are in the marketplace shopping, and you can hide in a crowd anytime. Where waves meet sand, we swim. This is guaranteed to take you from a cold, wet, dark Portland day to summer. Where sun meets water, we fish. And they are swimming underwater fishing with little poles. Where sky meets sea, we sail. Where wind meets hill, we run. And children are running up the hill and beautiful flowers in the background down the hill. Where music meets heart, we sing. And here are children in their red and white uniforms, and the boys in their just white uniforms with black ties are standing outside of a building singing. Where song meets soul, we dance. And they're just dancing, and some other children are playing instruments. Where years meet story, we see. And an old lady, late in the evening, telling stories to some small children. Where moonlight meets path, we walk. The children are walking home at night with their parents. Where darkness meets light, we dream. We dream. And a traditional African-type picture, or an island-type picture, where there are palm trees in the background, and two children are in profile, the moon, and geese are flying.
Oh, that sounds...
Beautiful book.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. It can't help but be.
Again, it's called Caribbean Dream. It's by Rachel Isadora. It's a scholastic book, and I think it would be most appropriate for a Christmas present for a child.
I think so, too. I want to read some books that are on a Best Books of 2005 list from the Black Issues website. Okay, let's see. Best Books of 2005, A Wreath for Emmett Till. Published in observance of the 50th anniversary of the murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till, who was murdered by lynching in Mississippi in 1955, Marilyn Nelson's sonnets explore innocence, brutalized with painstaking beauty. Again, A Wreath for Emmett Till by Marilyn Nelson. And Hewitt Anderson's Great Big Life. I should say, this first book, A Wreath for Emmett Till, is appropriate for youngsters ages 13 to 17. And then the next one, Hewitt Anderson's Great Big Life by Jerdine Nolan, illustrated by Kadir Nelson, is appropriate for youngsters 5 to 10 years old. Hewitt is everything his parents could want in a son, but there's just one problem. He's very, very small, and his family descends from a long line of proud giants, but it turns out that Hewitt's great big character is all he really needs. Again, that's Hewitt Anderson's Great Big Life by Jerdine Nolan, illustrated by Kadir Nelson. Growing Up in Slavery, Stories of Young Slaves is Told by Themselves, edited by Yuval Taylor. This is appropriate for youngsters 14 and up. Growing Up in Slavery presents intense autobiographical stories of life in bondage.
The heart-rending recollections will indeed give teens a deeper understanding of slavery. Growing up in slavery, stories of young slaves is told by themselves, edited by Yuval Taylor. Hot Jazz Special, words and pictures by Johnny Hanna, for children 6 to 10 years old. Hanna's book lists the spirits with snappy prose and exuberant pictures that capture the energy of jazz, introducing readers to some of the famous artists. And that again is Hot Jazz Special, words and pictures by Johnny Hanna. And then audiobooks. Ella Fitzgerald, The Tale of a Vocal Virtuoso, will write. You'd have to have an audiobook for Ella Fitzgerald. Okay, the book itself that accompanies the cassette is written and illustrated by Andrea Davis Pinckney and Brian Pinckney. The cassette is read by Billy D. Williams with original recordings by Ella Fitzgerald. So if you want to hear and learn about Ella, and everybody of every generation should, then you want the audiobook Ella Fitzgerald, The Tale of a Vocal Virtuosa by Andrea Davis Pinckney and Brian Pinckney. And next, Ellington Was Not a Street. This, again, is an audiobook. This one is by Intozaki Shange with Kadir Nelson, and it's read by Felicia Rashad. Oh, they have wonderful voices.
Yes.
Okay, so this is an unabridged cassette and a hardcover book. And it's all about Duke Ellington, so I think that's enough for me.
Yes.
You seen it?
I have the book right here in front of me.
Oh, my gosh.
In my classroom. It's a beautiful book.
Oh, well, I'm thinking if Kadir Nelson was involved as the illustrator, it would be beautiful. If you can get your hands on it before we go off the air, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it.
I have it right here. I'm walking to the shaft to grab it.
I tell you what, while you're doing that, I'm going to go into the next one and we'll come back. The last one on this list was Timepiece, The Book of Times, written by Virginia Hamilton, read by Lisa Renee Pitts. And again, anything by Virginia Hamilton is going to be a wonderful work of literature for young people. So I hope that parents will keep this in mind. Timepiece, The Book of Times, by Virginia Hamilton, read by Lisa Renee Pitts, and it's on Blackstone Audiobooks. Okay, Emma, have you put your hands on?
Yes.
Okay, great.
The cover looks like Intozaki Shange. Is it Shange or Shang?
I always thought it was Shange.
Shange, okay. It looks like a picture of her when she was a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she's holding an RCA Victor special, Moon Indigo, by Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra on the cover. And it's an illustration by Kadir Nelson, and I'm assuming this is her. It's a beautiful picture, just a lovely book. It's a story of when she was a little girl,
mm-hmm.
how Duke Ellington and other famous people like W.E.B. Du Bois came to her house. And that's what it's about her childhood and having famous people come in, and the fact that Ellington is not just the name of a street, but it was a man, was a real-life person.
Okay. I do want to mention, and if there's something else that you want to share, I'll hold off until you do that, but there are also some young adult reviews and a list of best books for young adults that I want to mention. And you may know, I can give the titles, you may actually know more about them as you get about this, since young adult literature is not necessarily my area of specialization. So do you want to introduce another title or give some commentary on the books that I'm going to share now?
I just want to tell you about one more book.
Okay.
I always like it when fairy tales are rewritten, an African-American retelling of a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this beautiful one called Leola and the Honey Bears. It's a retelling of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It is illustrated by Melody Benson Rosales, and she also wrote the book. The book has wonderful language in it. It has wonderful illustrations and wonderful language. You can't go wrong giving this to a child as a Christmas present or a Kwanzaa present. Kindergarten through fifth grade would totally love this book. This is a little sample of the language. You know how our relatives teach us good manners, our grandmothers, our mothers, our aunts? Well, this
is about good manners being taught to a little girl, but her not observing them, wandering in the woods one day and meeting this wonderful old weasel who is geed. I mean, he is so dressed up. He has on suspenders, pinstripe pants, a cute vest to match, a wool jacket with a sunflower as a pin. He has on those saddle Oxford shoes. He is too dressed up. He meets her in the woods, and he says to her, "Howdy, sweet little miss," he says in his oily voice. Oh, Mr. Weasel gave a sly smirk as he hungrily licked his lips. Leola quickly hopped her feet at the sight of the stranger. Oh, Mr. Weasel laughed out loud. Now, child, I don't mean to scare you none. He slithered around this way and that way. I was just wanting to eat you whole. Then she runs off in the woods, of course, and she comes upon a house, and she says, "This must be a stranger's house." Leola thought to herself as she looked back over her shoulder for old Mr. Weasel. "I know my grandmama told me about strangers, but I can't go back because old Mr. Weasel will eat me for sure." So Leola headed straight for the Honey Bear's Inn. She goes into their house and she sees all this wonderful food. And she's saying things like, "Ooh-wee, I'm so hungry. I know my grandmama said never help yourself in folks' kitchen until first being politely asked. But I don't think she'd mind this time." So, of course, she stuck her finger into the food and started to eat it. Later in the book, the bears come home, and she's sleeping in the bed, of course. And it starts like this. Startled, Leola woke up and saw three angry-looking bears leaning over her. "Oh, please don't eat me," she cried. "We're not going to eat you," Mama Honey Bear said sternly. "But didn't your folks teach you any manners?" The language is wonderful. The illustrations are wonderful. A great book. Can't go wrong with a present like this. Leola and the Honey Bears, an African-American retelling of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It's by Melody, M-E-L-O-D-Y-E, Benson Rosales, and is published by Scholastic Books.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to ask you for your comments on some of the titles that I'm going to mention now. Young Adult Best Books of 2005, as chosen by Black Issues Book Review Magazine. The first of all is The Coldest Winter Ever, which was actually published in 2000. But this is a book that's a perennial favorite of the youngsters I know who come into my branch, and I'm sure throughout the system and probably throughout the country. It is a tale of a young urban princess. Her father is a drug seller, and they live, in the beginning of the book, they live in the projects, but oh, talk about ghetto fabulous. I mean, this is the most wonderful, laid off, beautifully decorated ghetto apartment that you'll ever see.
They're laid off.
But the thing is, I have read a number of these books, I'm sure you have too, and some are so predictable. What I love about this book is that the story of this young girl who has a lot to learn, the protagonist just thinks she has it all if her nails are done and she has the latest styles. It is not the typical story, and there's a lot to be learned. So I would just recommend The Coldest Winter Ever. I completely agree with that one. Clover by Dori Saunders, I have not read. Are you familiar with that, Emma?
No, I've never read it.
Okay, well, then we'll just move on and let you know that that's one. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, a classic that I think many of us are familiar with. I mean, it's been out for many years. Looking for Red by Angela Johnson. I've read something else by Angela Johnson, but not this one. This came out in 2003. Emma, is this one of the ones that you know about?
No, I've never heard of that one either.
Well, see, this is good, then. We're building some things for our list. And the last one they have is Stay Strong, Simple Life Lessons for Teens. This came out in 2002. Terry Williams was the public relations director for Essence Magazine for a number of years, and then she went out on her own and has, like, mega, mega, mega stars as her clients. But she does a lot of work with young people, and I have seen this book, and it's just a really positive, practical sort of a book for youngsters to kind of keep them on the right track. So I would recommend that too and concur with their listings of outstanding books. I guess these are the ones that were the most popular this year. I do want to mention several things in the remaining minutes. First of all, to sort of close out our Kwanzaa information,
I do want to say that the Kwanzaa celebrations around the city are beginning to be identified. At this point, I know that on the first day of Kwanzaa, which is Monday, December 26th, at 6 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Recreational Center, there will be the opening celebration for Kwanzaa. So you want to look out for that because that's going to set the season off. And we hope if there are any of our friends from New Orleans and anyone from that area who is new to the city, please take note and please attend these events because we want to give you a really great Portland Kwanzaa welcome and bring you into the family on these events. So the first one is Monday, 12/26 at Matt Dishman. The second event, which will be very much a children's event, will be on Tuesday, December 27th at 6 p.m. at the North Portland Branch Library in the auditorium. So we want you to come back and join us again for that. On Wednesday, December 28th, the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center will have its Kwanzaa celebration. And I think this is the first time that IFCC has not had their event on, it seems like it's always on a Saturday. That's probably not true. But I think theirs has always been for Kuumba Creativity. But at any rate, theirs will now be on the third day. The flyers are being prepared. They'll be out, so please look for them. I'm sure information will be in local newspapers and also heard on this station. So as more Kwanzaa events are announced, they will be there. And we're going to get them up on the Black Resource Center website that the library has. So I wanted to get that out. I wanted to say also that there are a number of wonderful adult books that have come out, and I hope that those of you who are looking for good things to read will go to Black Issues Book Review, look up the information on Step and Fetch It, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry, because this is a time when we look at our elders. Walter Mosley has a new book out, as does Octavia Butler. So lots of good stuff out here for you for December. We look forward to talking to you again in the beginning of the year. I wish happy holidays to all of you, whatever holiday you're celebrating. This is Patricia Welch signing off.
This is Emma Jackson for Bookwoman, and I look forward to talking to you next month.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Kwanzaa, a step to unity.
Kwanzaa,
a step to being free.
Kwanzaa,
help us to see that we are in control of our destiny. Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa,
a step to unity.
Kwanzaa,
a step to being free.
Kwanzaa,
help us to see that we are in control of our destiny. Kwanzaa is based on tradition and reason. It's a value system for any season.
Kwanzaa,
a step to unity.
Kwanzaa,
a step to being free.
Kwanzaa,
help us to see that we are in control of our destiny.
The time is a minute after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Still to come on this morning's Radio Zine at 10:30, it's Stage and Studio with host Dee Mae Roberts. She's featuring a new film about the bomb hunters in Cambodia, and we'll hear part two of the John Lennon tribute. This segment of the Radio Zine features an interview with Marge Piercy, author of Sex Wars. And Marge Piercy will be speaking in Portland as a benefit for Planned Parenthood Thursday, December 8th, 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church. That's on 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. She'll read from and sign her newest book, Sex Wars. And there is a $25 donation, $12 for students, $100 for a pre-event reception, includes a copy of the book, and there will be limited seating.
Marge Piercy is the author of 16 books of poetry and 17 novels, several books of nonfiction, and is the editor of an anthology of women's poetry called Early Ripening. She will be in Oregon this week on a reading tour to promote her newest published book, Sex Wars, a historical novel that takes place in the great social ferment of the mid to late 19th century in the pre- and post-Civil War period. We speak to Marge now by phone, and I want to welcome you to KBOO, Marge Piercy.
Thank you.
Sex Wars is an unusual historical novel told primarily through the stories of and in the character of four completely different people. Three actual historical characters, the writer, entrepreneur, feminist Victoria Woodhull, the suffragist and early feminist Elizabeth...
I really wish you would not call her a suffragist. That is a later period. Everyone always thinks of that period. She would have described herself as a woman's rights activist. Well, she didn't use activist, that's a current term, but a woman's rights person.
Right,
She was interested in many things besides suffrage.
Well, there was a whole bunch of, there was the temperance movement, the abolitionist movement, just a tremendous amount of ferment that was going on then. And I realized that there was also internecine struggle then, which we'll talk about and which you write about. In fact, you chronicle the history of this developing movement just very, very in depth and in a very fascinating way. But so she was a women's rights activist.
Yeah, they talked about women's rights.
Women's rights activist.
Rights.
And her associate...
It's like, you know, the ascent of man. They were in the Victorian times, they were prone to say man, woman.
Okay.
You know?
And her associate... right. Women,
right.
And then her associate, Susan B. Anthony, and Anthony Comstock, who was a John Ashcroft-like character...
Oh, quite. Very few people have actually heard of him, but his laws are still on the books, and they're still used.
That's right.
They've never been repealed.
It's astounding because he came out of nowhere, and perhaps, well, one thing I was going to ask you, you wrote about this period. Why did you choose to now write about this period? And there are very obvious parallels to what was happening.
Gee, I can't imagine why. The big issues of that day were abortion, contraception, the rights of women and minorities, immigration, the economy. Could Christianity be the official religion? The Bible be taught in schools? Censorship and election fraud. A stolen election.
Isn't that amazing? And
yes. And you wonder why I wrote about that period.
Is it a coincidence that the women's movement developed in the aftermath of war?
The women's movement developed actually out of the abolitionist movement.
That's right.
In a very similar way that the second wave of the women's movement came out of the civil rights and the anti-war movements in the 60s. And early 70s.
And there were struggles. Just prior to the Civil War, there was a tremendous surge of idealistic social movement. And
continuing afterwards.
Continuing afterwards.
Yeah.
It was a very rich period, very similar to, in some ways, important ways, the period from the late 60s in America to now, when in some senses we're fighting those same battles over again.
Oh, yes.
But
you said Comstock came out of nowhere.
Uh-huh.
Comstock had the backing of the YMCA, which had on its board most of the richest and most powerful men in New York. And they were very concerned with the morality of their sons and the morality of their workers. They didn't want workers dissipating themselves, spending too much energy on a good time, whatever. So they were very worried about drink and sexual morality and entertainment and so forth.
And there was a movement at the same period to make Christianity the official Orthodox state religion.
And to teach Bible in the schools, yes.
But
it was narrowly defeated.
Uh-huh.
For the same reason they want to do it now. They're convinced they have the truth.
That's right. And March, did this intersect with, I mean, the fact that the politicians jumped on board Was that also related to the fact that, similar to now, there were scandals, financial scandals?
There were huge financial mm-hmm. scandals. At the time that Comstock got his laws through Congress, there was this terrible financial scandal. It extended up to the vice president's office. Under Ulysses Grant, there was one scandal after another. He was a very laissez-faire president, and he didn't really get it. And he liked his cronies he was comfortable with, and they were all out to make a buck. So, or many bucks. So that was part of it. Another thing is that Comstock used very McCarthyist tactics. If someone opposed him on free speech, he'd dig up some dirt on them. He was never afraid to do that because there was no dirt to dig up on him.
Uh-huh, that's right.
He wasn't
right.
interested in money.
Uh-huh.
He was faithful to his wife, you know, at their wedding night in the novel. He actually was a very good husband. He
uh-huh.
was just a terrible political person.
Well, he was just a narrow, pinched fellow. And you didn't go into the deep psychology, but the fact is that his mother died when he was a child. His father was a nasty, uptight fellow, and his mother was deeply religious. But, you know, I wonder if you might read to us a section. Do you have the book there?
What would you like a section?
Well,
this
one is Anthony. It talks about his early rise. It's page 334. When he came to Washington, to the Capitol, with a display of dildos and condoms and birth control pills and postcards and sex novels. And
now,
actually,
what page did you want?
It's page 334. And Comstock brought this display to Washington, and the vice president invited him to display it right in...
Yeah, the vice president was in political trouble.
That's right. So this was a...
So it was very helpful to him.
And this is page 334. Vice President Colfax was eager to display zeal.
Vice President Colfax... This is not one of the excerpts I usually read. Usually I do one from each of them. Victoria was such a lively person.
Oh, I know, and I have some from her, too, so hopefully...
Vice President Colfax was eager to display zeal on the side of righteousness, as were others implicated in the railroad scandal. Anthony's placard behind the item said, "These are examples of what is being sent through the mail to our innocent children in boarding schools across the nation." Now he had the attention of the legislators. They fingered one item after another, asking him what they did. Several would not actually touch the lurid objects, but poked them with a walking stick. They paid particular attention to the French postcards and the etchings, which they studied carefully. He appreciated their interest now that he had finally aroused it. Benjamin Butler came in. Benjamin Butler is not on Comstock's side. He's a lover of Victoria Woodhull.
Uh-huh.
Comstock later arrested. Benjamin Butler came in, looked over the table, and had the audacity to wink at him as if he were somehow involved in this smut. "Not a bad collection," the senator said in his ear, "but Vice President Colfax has a better one. You should ask to see it." When Anthony had finished his spiel on the dangers to the youth of the nation, the senators and congressmen professed themselves ready to give him whatever law he needed. Few in Congress wanted to be seen as defending obscenity, although there were stubborn souls who insisted on blabbing about freedom of speech in the press, freedom to corrupt the innocent. He was working full-time, pressing the flesh, telling tales of his arrests and his trials, working them all. There would be inserted into the last appropriations bill before adjournment a special agent of the post office who would wield vast new powers to confiscate immoral... Hello?
Yes.
Or to confiscate immoral matter in the mails and arrest those sending it, powers to search, to seize, and to arrest. The special agent, everybody understood, would be him. Anthony insisted on serving without pay. If the agent were a paid office, it would be used to... as patronage, but if it were unpaid, he could have it all. For all he could have it for all any politician would care. So I would pay his salary anyhow.
He becomes an officer of New York, the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice.
When we're doing the PowerPoint display that we do at bookstores, I have a picture of the motto, the seal of the Society for the Suppression of Vice. On one side, they're burning books. On the other side, they're carting booksellers and writers off to jail.
And the amazing thing is they had a financial arrangement where the society would receive half the fines of those people Anthony Comstock or his assistants arrested. So it was a sweetheart financial deal. And those laws were actually in effect in terms of mailing and obscenity for almost 100 years. I mean, they got fought in
they're still in effect.
They still are in effect.
Yeah. He was especially anxious to prevent any material on birth control or abortion from going through the mails. He also hated the women's rights movement, and he hated any kind of free-thinking philosophy, any kind of radicalism. And it was all obscene to him.
Uh-huh.
But that's only part of the book. There are three other major characters.
Well, and you, that's what I was going to ask you. Would mm-hmm. perhaps, I have to say that it's brilliant the way this book is done, because the stories and the characters are all very different. The middle class and educated Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Victoria Woodhull, the free lover, and...
Who came up out of utter poverty.
And a rascal, a family of con artists, spiritualists, and rascals.
Pat Hayden Medicine, Coker's Hot Plate. They started on the revivalist circuit. She and her sister Tennessee were exploited by their father
and
living. And if they didn't make enough money, then he wouldn't let them eat.
Would you like to give us just a little taste of each of the characters? You know what passages you like to read and are good for this. So perhaps I picked for Victoria. After she was down and out, she was very...
I think that I'd like to read a little section from the first chapter.
Great.
I think it's better to... It's easier sometimes for people to follow when you're first introducing a character.
Okay.
In just one moment, I'll find it. I wasn't expecting to be reading.
It
takes a moment.
Well, as I...
Okay. You... Whoops, that's right. I got to find the story. I'm looking. Sorry.
And I'll just tell folks that each of the characters is there is described in sections that are very, very different in voice and tone, so that you've done a masterful writing job.
I always do that. I like things to sound. I like to be inside the mind of the character.
Uh huh.
Okay, and here is, they have come, she, Tennessee and she have come to New York.
Okay, her sister.
From the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And they have made a great study of the richest man in the United States, Cornelius Vanderbilt. Now, Cornelius Vanderbilt had regular office hours in which any supplicant had 5 minutes, and 5 minutes only, in which to grab his attention. And they're going to him. They have an idea of how they're going to get him to help. They have no money.
That's right.
The flunky ushered them into Vanderbilt's inner office. What can I do for you, ladies? The portly old man was stuffed into a chair that barely fit him. He was a big man still, with a high forehead where his hair had receded in a penetrating dark gaze. He sat in his chair like a bear brought into the parlor, the shoulders and arms of a man who'd done hard work in his time. He wore old-fashioned clothes, a dark and rumpled suit coat and white cravat. Victoria doubted he thought twice about his clothing in the last 40 years. He still made a powerful presence. In his prime, she might have found him attractive. Penny still would. The smell of money and power would work for her as it wouldn't for Victoria. "We've come," Victoria said in her clear contralto voice, "to offer our help to you. We're both spiritual adepts who have had great success over the years in putting people in communication with their loved ones who have passed over. We're also magnetic healers, again with years of successful practice. I want to put you in communication with your mother, and my sister is going to ease some of your physical problems. You tell us when you want us to start." They both beamed at him, and Tennessee leaned a little forward, flashing him some cleavage.
And
quite a tall order, my dears, quite a tall order. I've gone through 40 mediums over the decades since my mother passed on, and I've had paltry success. They're scallywags and frauds, and the same with healers. Therefore, if we can't help you, you can say goodbye. We won't charge you. Everybody charges. What's your racket? If we help you, you'll help us. If we can't help you, then we're off, and you're none the worse for it. Now, how's that for a bargain? No risk to you. What about you, the redhead? Haven't got much to say for yourself. He inserted a wad of chewing tobacco into his jowly cheek. I'm more of a physical worker, Tenny said, imbuing the statement with innuendo. I can help you, but not sitting across the desk.
And they did help Cornelius Vanderbilt, in fact, and he helped them. And Victoria and her sister were the very first women stockbrokers in the world. They set up a brokerage firm.
And it was quite successful.
Very successful. Uh-huh. And they got
ran for president. First woman to do that, too. First woman to address Congress.
And totally totally liberated sexually and outspoken about it, which in fact compromised her friend and fellow women's activist Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who after meeting her embraced her, and Victoria, she was informed by the respectable people that that Victoria was unsavory and would compromise the women's movement, and Elizabeth would never. Elizabeth, while not sexually active outside of her marriage,
she had seven children.
She had seven children. Well, outside of her marriage,
yeah.
She appreciated that Victoria acted on her inclinations and was honest about it and never would renounce Victoria. So there was a split in the women's movement between the respectable people, top-down hierarchical organization, and the national movement, the New York and the Boston faction. The New York faction was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and they had a paper called Revolution. Do you perhaps, do you have a passage that might give us an insight into Stanton?
Certainly. How about, now this is before, this is when she first moves to Seneca Falls.
Uh-huh.
When she moves there, she's begun having her children. It was a rough river. Seneca Falls was a rough river town with many taverns and many churches, not much else. She made friends with the neighbor women, though they found her forward and unconventional. She charmed them into liking her against their will, but she was lonely. Her husband Henry took the train to Albany and Washington on a regular basis to register patents for clients. He also traveled on political business, not so much abolitionist now as Republican Party politics. He wanted to run for some, for any state office. He was intensely ambitious for himself, that felt she should be satisfied being a mother and housewife. He gradually lost interest in discussing ideas with her, and when he was home, insisted she let him read the paper, smoke his pipe, and that she keep the children from pestering him. Basically, he came home to relax and be cosseted. Then I'll skip down to Lucretia Mott, an old friend of Elizabeth's, comes to Seneca Falls, and they decide they're going to hold a small meeting to discuss the issue of women's rights. They anticipate they might get 20 people if anybody comes. The morning of July 19th arrived. Lucretia and Elizabeth went to the Methodist Church reserved for the meeting. A crowd of women and some men were milling about outside. The streets were blocked with carriages. Elizabeth was astonished and almost frightened. They'd placed only a small notice in the local paper. Lucretia murmured at her ear, "We forgot to say women only. We assumed men would not be interested." "Too late to think of that," Elizabeth said. "We'll seat them." The church door was locked. Elizabeth was sure someone had gotten to the minister and scared him. She boosted her nephew up to a window he could open. He slid into the church and a few minutes later let them in. By the time everyone filed in and those who could be accommodated were seated, they counted 267 women and 40 men. Elizabeth felt overwhelmed. Even Lucretia was used to making speeches, seemed reluctant to start. Her husband James took the podium, welcomed the overflow crowd, and formally opened the meeting. He called on Elizabeth. Waves of hot blood and cold fear washed through her. When she stood, her knees trembled under her heavy skirts. Was she out of her mind, as her husband Henry and her father thought? Questioning the roles of men and women was like questioning the rain. It just was. She began, "We gather here today to discuss our wrongs, civil and political." Then she began to read her declaration of sentiments. She felt faint with worry, remembering Henry's response. Would they laugh her out of the building? Would they rise and walk out? Her voice quavered at first. She cleared her throat and continued. People were stirring in their pews, women fanning themselves in the heat of the humid July morning, people greeting each other, waving, women with babies on their laps jouncing them. But before she had read halfway through her second paragraph, she felt something she had never experienced before, the intense, mesmeric response of a crowd whose attention has been utterly captured. Between her sentences, you could hear horses outside in a passing carriage, the cries of robins and sparrows in the trees. But inside the church, except for her strengthening voice, a silence received her words, and when she looked up from her text, every gaze was intent upon her. That's when Elizabeth discovers that she has the gift of moving crowds.
That's right, and the fact that she and Lucretia put this on out of nowhere in five days.
They got the idea and they did it a week later.
They did it a week later, and hundreds of people, they thought they'd be happy. They thought maybe 40 people would come and it wouldn't be a failure if 25 came.
And Douglas came?
Yeah, 300 people came, and it was the same later when Victoria... years later, when Victoria went around giving her talks on sex, hundreds and hundreds of people would come. So there was something in the air. The time was ripe, and this great reaction happened. And the reaction came both from the good men, the men in the abolitionist movement, and on the left, and from Anthony Comstock and the religious zealots who...
Well, remember how, I don't know if you're old enough to remember how men in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement responded to women starting to talk about...
That's right.
But it wasn't positive at all.
Well, if we had more time, it would be wonderful to get into that because we were in San Francisco. I was in San Francisco in the 60s and recognized... many of the paths that you talked about. But alas, Marge, our time is just about up here.
We never got to talk about Freda.
And this is, let's just say Freda is a beautiful character in a beautiful story. She's a composite character, an immigrant, a Jewish immigrant woman, widowed shortly after she and her husband got here from the Pale. And where was that? In I wasn't sure if it was Belarus, Poland.
It was part of the Russian Empire where Jews were allowed to live. She lost her only, the only time she was pregnant, she lost it when her husband was killed. And so she collects, there are thousands and thousands of throwaway children living on the streets of New York. Thousands of them. And she starts collecting them.
And
adopting them.
And her story is a very moving and heartfelt story, full of detail about the life of the poor women and ghetto women in that time.
And she's trying to find her younger sister who is lost in New York City, and she is on this quest. to find her.
And we will have to leave it to readers to seek the book, to seek to hear you read from the book. This book is...
Yeah, I'll be doing a combination of poetry and excerpts from the novel.
We'll give you details. I want to thank you very much for this interview, Marge Piercy. And Marge, very quickly, what do you think is the role of young women today in, where is the women's struggle, do you think?
It's wherever women want it to be.
Wherever women want
Where
it to be.
People work on the issues that most touch them.
Uh-huh.
That's what works best.
That's right. And you have been listening to Marge Piercy, and she's in Oregon this week as a benefit for Planned Parenthood, talking and reading from her new book, Sex Wars, which is a fascinating history that mirrors and sheds light on what's happening, many things that are happening today in American society. Marge, I'm glad to have talked to you, and I hope folks read your book and come hear you.
And thank you.
Thank you very much. This is Barbara Morticella, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Marge Piercy, author of Sex Wars, speaks as a benefit for Planned Parenthood Thursday, December 8th, 2005, 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. Marge will read from and sign her newest book, Sex Wars. There's a $25 donation, $12 for students, $100 for the pre-event reception, which includes a copy of the book, and there is limited seating. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from St. John's Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard in St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032. Stay tuned for Stage and Studio.
Welcome to Stage and Studio. I'm Dima Roberts. Today, the lasting effects of war in Cambodia. We'll hear about a new film supported by the Cambodian American community of Oregon in Portland about bomb hunters. It's getting their first public screening this Saturday at the Hollywood Theater. And in the last part of the show, we'll conclude our tribute to John Lennon. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. With me in the KABU studio is Chan Lee Bob of the Cambodian American Community of Oregon. Good morning, Chan Lee.
Good morning.
And with him are two filmmakers, Patty Duncan, associate producer of Bomb Hunters. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning.
And with us via phone is the director and producer of Bomb Hunters, Sky Fitzgerald, who's in Los Angeles right now. Am I right, Sky?
Yep, that's right.
All right. Talk a little bit closer to the mic. Not to the mic, but to the phone.
Yeah, how's
okay,
that work?
Great. That's great. You're finishing up on the final touches of the Bomb Hunters film, so I want to welcome you all to Stage and Studio. Let's start first with Chan Lee. Tell us a bit more about the organization that you are involved with, the Cambodian American Community of Oregon, and how many Cambodians it serves.
The Cambodian American Community of Oregon has been around since 1989, and it was formed mainly to help the Cambodians who came to America. You know, they're basically to help cope help people cope with this the difficulties of you know, adapting to the new way of life here in America.
Portland has a pretty large Cambodian community too that came after the whole, you know, Vietnam, post-Vietnam War, and mostly through the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
That is correct. I came over in 1982 through the kindness and blessings of the church in Albany. They were able to sponsor my family over, and in the mid 70s, the people who made it out in 75 and so forth are usually the few that are in the higher rankings of the part of the doctors or people who were fortunate enough to know and to be able to escape out of the country. But for myself, you know, poor farmers in Battambang area, we weren't so lucky, and we struggled in the refugee camps in Thailand and in the Philippines. And fortunately, we were lucky to get out in 1982 and lived in Albany for since 82.
In talking with you many times, I know that the CACO is very involved in Cambodia and what's happening right now, as well as doing events here in Portland and throughout Oregon, really, for the Cambodian American community to unite. But they're also involved, the CACO, in helping out Cambodia as well.
That is correct. We have a program called Beyond Ordinary Borders, which basically humanitarian missions in Cambodia. We encourage people who are fortunate to be living the American dream to go back and give a piece of themselves to Cambodia, because you know in Cambodia there's so many people who are needing help. You know, it's common where you have children carry the responsibility, the heavy burden of having to help support the family, and instead of playing video games or going to a mall or hanging out with friends, you know, they're out there trying to survive, and it's quite sad. And it's I was one of them, and for me to not, for us to not think about them, it's just disturbing.
Well, one of the issues to think about too is the problem of landmines and unexploded bombs in Cambodia. You're listening to Stage and Studio, and the Cambodian American Community of Oregon is sponsoring the first public screening of Bomb Hunters at the Hollywood Theater this Saturday, December 10th. And we're talking to Charlie Bob of CACO, and also two filmmakers I want to bring into the conversation, Patty and Sky. Let's start with Sky. How did you become interested in doing this film about bomb hunters in Cambodia?
Well, in 2000, I co-produced a film in Cambodia about the child prostitution industry. And while I was there, through the course of shooting the film, I really became familiar with just how much the legacy of war continues to affect contemporary Cambodians.
Sky, I want to just interrupt you. Just speak really directly into the phone.
Okay.
We're having a hard time hearing you.
Okay, got it. I was saying that in 2000, I produced another film in Cambodia, and at that point became educated about the legacy of war in Cambodia and how it continues to affect contemporary Cambodians in very immediate fashion throughout the country. And I began researching the unexploded ordnance and landmine contamination issue pretty steadily since 2000, and my interest just continued to grow from there.
And how did you get involved in doing the film? You got a Fulbright, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I first went to a number of different broadcast television entities thinking that this would really be a wonderful program to get on broadcast television, and it was interesting because a number of them, including the History Channel, all said this is a great story and it should be told, and our listeners probably don't want to hear it. And I didn't believe that. I didn't buy into that, and so I decided to sort of take the funding issue more the academic route and applied for a Fulbright research grant to see if I could get them to fund the research and shooting stage of it, and they said yes. And so I went with Patty and Chris Parkhurst as a sound person, and we spent 6 months throughout Cambodia and Vietnam shooting and documenting the whole phenomenon of the harvesting of the remnants of war for profit.
How big of a problem is this, Patty? Let's get you in the conversation. Mm-hmm. How big of a problem are the landmines and the unexploded ordnance in Cambodia?
Well, it's a huge problem, I think that many of us in this country are not educated enough about what a big problem this is. But these bombs basically litter the countryside of Cambodia, and many of them are due to the secret illegal bombing done by the U.S. During the war in Vietnam.
And how did you go about, both you and Sky spent 6 months in Cambodia, is that correct?
Well, he did, and Chris Parkhurst, our editor, did, but I was not there for the entire time. I had to come back for my teaching job, and I was there for part of the time and involved in other ways while I was not there.
So, Sky, how did you chronicle the bomb hunters?
That's a great question. You know, the scale of the problem is, I think we should just lay it out. First, you know, between 1968 and 73, over the course of a mere 5 years, there were over 20 million landmines, cluster munitions, and bombs dropped on Cambodia.
Closer to the phone.
Yeah, and a problem, I said there's that over the course of 5 years, 20 million landmines, cluster munitions, and bombs were dropped on Cambodia. And that sort of legacy is simply not going to be cleaned up overnight. And so we had learned about this issue, I had, when I was there in 2000, and continued to research it with contacts I'd made in Cambodia, as well as people in the mine action sector in Cambodia, and learned quite quickly that it was a problem. Cambodia is really just a microcosm for other points of conflict throughout the world, and we decided at that point to study it in Cambodia, both through the mine action agencies who are out in the field, trying to do mine risk education to teach villagers what to do if they find ordnance, but also through sort of the undocumented work of villagers throughout the countryside who have come to see the metal from ordnance and the TNT and explosive elements within the ordnance as an opportunity rather than something just to be avoided. And that was a real ironic twist for us, because now in places like Cambodia, where developmental issues are pretty dire, people really see ordnance as an opportunity to make some money.
Now, they sell it for scrap. I mean, they sell the scrap metal basically to make money. And I saw a clip from the film, and I was just stunned to see these kids actually sawing into the bomb to get the metal off. I mean, how common is that?
Well, you know, you would hope it wasn't common at all, but. But the reality is it's much more common than we even thought it was. The recycling of ordnance for profit, both to fish with, essentially improvised explosive devices, a lot relating to Iraq, to fish with, but also just to sell the metal, as you noted, is very common on the village level throughout the country.
And I'm just curious, you know, what is the Cambodian government doing about this?
I wish they were doing a lot more. They talk a lot about doing a lot of things to sort of curb this practice, and the reality is there is a lot of action that is working to sort of to offset this whole phenomenon. But the fact is, it's really an issue of it's a developmental issue as well as an issue of contamination. I mean, yes, the ordnance needs to be methodically cleared and disposed of in the short term, but the fact is, if villagers had other viable forms of income and better education, they'd be less likely to turn to the harvesting of ordnance as an option in the first place. And that's where many of the mine action agencies throughout Cambodia are trying to sort of urge and nudge the Cambodian government towards approaching the issue from a developmental standpoint rather than a mine risk education, don't touch this, because the fact is, they're choosing to touch it for profit.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger, you or Patty, you know, when you were filming this?
Sure.
Patty's nodding her head saying yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, you know, they're what you were running that risk of you know, just as much as the bomb hunters were.
I think what was really important, though, is that for many people in Cambodia, that's just a daily part of life. They live with that risk every day.
Well, Bomb Hunters will have its first public screening December 10th at the Hollywood Theater at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The theater's number is 503-281-4215, 281-4215. You can go to the Hollywood box office, which is open 9 to 5 in their office at this number, or reserve tickets that way. Doors open at 6:30 on December 10th with live Cambodian music, and that will run through for an hour until 7:30 when the film will start. We suggest getting there early because, according to Chan Lee Bob here, that the tickets are selling well and it's about half sold out now. So tickets are $8 and are available at the door or in advance at ticketweb.com or at the Hollywood box office. And there will be an additional show Sunday, December 11th at 3 o'clock, a matinee. And for more information, I suggest you go to bombhunters.com because that's a great site, you guys. It's just wonderful. And also to cacooregon.org, which is the Cambodian American Community of Oregon. And in the time remaining, first off, I just want to, Sky, just commend you for this great work. It's a 90-minute film. I hope you get great distribution. I know you're working on that. And I hope that History Channel and Discovery Channel or whatever channel will say, we blew it, you know, when you guys win an award for this, several awards, I hope. Chan Lee, this is also Cambodian Heritage Month. So CACO is doing another event, which is happening on December 31st.
Yes, ma'am. It's going to be at the Doubletree Hotel. There's going to be live cultural performances from our youth dancers. They've been practicing for many, many months on just to they're excited and they want to showcase this, their what they've learned and practiced so hard for to the American public. And
so they're going to be performing Cambodian dance, and you can have lots of food and all kinds of dancing for the public as well, and live music and all that, right?
Well, you know, one of the great things about the Cambodian party is always music, there's always dancing, there's always laughter, there's always great food, and that's one of my favorite things when family, friends, and even strangers come and help celebrate this 2005.
That's a great, interesting, different way to spend New Year's. It's December 31st. What time does it start?
6:30.
And how much is it?
It is $35. If you buy pre-sale tickets, it's $35. But if you want to wait until the last minute comes to the door, and $40 is the price.
And where is it?
Doubletree Hotel at Lloyd.
All right. Well, I'll be there. Celebrating the new year with you, Chan Lee. Chan Lee Bob, Patty Duncan, and Sky Fitzgerald, thank you so much for, you know, doing this film and presenting it to the Portland community. And it's going to have its premiere showing, public showing, this Saturday, December 10th at the Hollywood Theater. So thank you all for joining us here on Stage and Studio.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Now we turn to part two of our John Lennon special commemorating his work towards peace. This is produced by Paul Ingalls for Hearing Voices, hosted by Lynn Neary.
Also at the Dakota, it appears an impromptu memorial is being staged right now. There's hundreds of Beatles fans outside mourning.
But it was always for peace.
Do you remember where you were when you heard the news? That's the question Paul Ingalls asked people about the day John Lennon died.
December 8th, 1980, I was in the United States Navy at the time. I was aboard the aircraft carrier Ranger. We were on station in the North Arabian Sea.
I was going down to what I would call maintenance control, get information through the night, and usually about 2 or 3 in the morning, the ship's little rag, the Border Ranger called the Top Gun Gazette, would come out, usually 3 or 4 pages, and I still have it 20 years later. Title: John Lennon Shot to Death in New York. AP: John Lennon, the former Beatle, was shot to death in New York City Monday night. The shooting occurred outside Lennon's apartment building on the city's Upper West Side. Lennon, who just had his 40th birthday in October, was rushed by police car to Roosevelt Hospital. It was there he was pronounced dead.
December 8th, 1980, I do remember. I was working as a bartender at the time, working nights, and it was a Monday night, and I went into the bar, and the Monday night football was on the big screen TV.
Confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, may be the best-known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment.
And Howard Cosell is saying something about the terrible tragedy that happened to John Lennon in New York City tonight.
An unspeakable tragedy.
And pretty quickly it became apparent that there had been a terrible tragedy and that John Lennon had been murdered.
And this guy comes running in and he said, John Lennon's been killed. And I went out to my car and turned on the radio, and all the way across the dial you heard Beatles songs. And it was as if the, you know, the world had stopped.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Hold on. Now I'm just going to raise this so it's nearer the bass strings than the top string. Paul's broken at last. Broken at last. Paul's broken at last. At last. At last. He's broke today. Okay. Oh, you ready, Macca? 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on, feeling 2 foot small. Death, each and every day, I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, hey, you've got to hide your love away.
One of my favorite Lennon tracks. Actually, you can usually go back to the Beatles and tell which one was mainly a Lennon song or a McCartney song. And one that really hit me, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. It was very simple, I think a nice little love song, and I thought it was very straight to the point and Lennon from the heart.
Hey, you've got to hide your love away. How can I even try? I can never win. Hearing them, seeing them in the state I'm in. How could she say to me, love will find a way? Gather round, all you clowns, let me hear you say, hey, you've got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide your love away.
I was at home when I heard the news about John Lennon, and I remember very clearly thinking with a sinking feeling, this is the end. Our hopes for the Beatles possibly ever getting back together are completely dashed. This is the end.
December 8th, 1980, I was laying on a mattress in Upland, California, watching television about 7 or 8 p.m., and I was strung out on heroin, and the news comes on and says that John Lennon had died. And me and a bunch of other junkies couldn't believe it.
It was, you were incredibly sad. You were upset and depressed for all of humanity, you know, that there's these kind of things can take place.
On December 8th, 1980, I was at a grocery store when the checkout lady came by and said, "Did you hear that John Lennon was just shot?" And she said it was either John Lennon or Jack Lemmon. She couldn't remember. And I remember going out to my car and turning on the radio and hoping it was Jack Lemmon. But no, it was John Lennon. That night, local radio station set up a van and some big speakers, and it was a cold night, and a lot of people were staying out there listening to John's music and signing a big sympathy card to Yoko, and I still remember what I signed on it, and it was a John Lennon quote that said, "Last night the wife said, oh boy, when you're dead, you don't take nothing with you but your soul."
I remember being in the Chapultepec Park area of Mexico City where there was a candlelight vigil going on. My guess is that there were probably a million people. I had no idea at the time how popular and how revered John Lennon was in Mexico.
Well, it was early morning. I can remember that my father called up and said, "John Lennon's been shot. Turn on the radio." And I couldn't really believe it. And I was eagerly anticipating the birth of my first child. And at that time, the baby was overdue. And so I can remember thinking with this note of sadness, "Oh, no, I hope the baby doesn't come today. What a terrible way to start your life. Such a bad omen that such an amazing figure is gone." I can remember thinking, why would anybody want to kill this man?
On December 8, 1980, I was midway through my pregnancy with my first child. And when we got the news that John Lennon had been shot, I remember that my husband burst into tears. And it was very emotional for us, not only because we had admired John Lennon since we were in high school, but also because we knew that he was leaving behind a five-year-old son.
Because the world is round, it turns me on. Because the world is
my all-time favorite John Lennon song has to be Imagine. I think that's probably a lot of people's favorite.
I've known good friends who'd chosen to get married to Imagine.
I think the one song that affected me the most that Lennon did was Imagine, because it gave a sense of hope.
Imagine.
I was working at a record store in Chicago at the time of John Lennon's death, and we had this huge stack of Double Fantasy. It had just come out and was a fairly well-received album. And I'm looking at this amount of albums that we have here, and I'm thinking about John Lennon. I'm thinking, he can't die. He's one of the Beatles. He's invincible. And then 2 days later, when I came back to work, those albums were gone. They were completely gone. People had come in and completely bought them out.
Imagine no possession. I wonder if we can
greed or hunger. A brotherhood and sisterhood of man.
I would say that John Lennon crosses my mind every time I do something political, every time I do something I believe in or teach my child about what I believe in. I don't want to put him up on a pedestal because he wasn't a perfect human. I think about him.
The day John Lennon died, as remembered by Scott McNichol, Daniel Callis, Martin Goldsmith, Jane Bloom, Mark Weber, Jim Palmer, John Scariano, Bonnie Renfro, Mary Oishi, Bob Rauchy, and Emily Zambello. The piece was produced by Paul Ingalls at Cedar Creek Studios and KUNM Albuquerque. And that was the Hearing Voices special. To hear lots of creative audio, go to hearingvoices.com. Before we go today, we have a ticket giveaway for Portland Center Stage's This Wonderful Life, a one-man show based on the film It's a Wonderful Life. It's running through December 24th downtown at the Portland Center for the Performing Arts. We'll take the third caller at 503-231-8032. 231-8032. That's it for Stage and Studio this week. Next week, we feature a special holiday concert with Aaron Meyer and Bill Lamb right here in the KBOO Studios. Till then, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
As part of healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!